department that needs to be addressed.
Call the House Interim Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water to order. Today is May the 23rd. Welcome everybody from near and far who came over to talk with us. We're going to start quickly on the Owyhee Canyon issue just for a moment to hear from Representative Smith, who has another meeting he needs to go to. Then we have a little hearing on the Watershed Enhancement Board. Then we come back to a long one on Owyhee. So a little bit other topic, come back, unless you're all here for the OWEB proposal, but I don't think so. No offense, OWEB. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57. But I want to be very transparent. By Constitution, our founding fathers wanted us to have other jobs. And the other job that I have is I'm the Economic Development Director for Malheur County. And so just very, very briefly, I want to share just a few points with you to let you know that over 60 people have traveled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles to testify today, or to just to be participating in, participate in an informational hearing. And I greatly appreciate you holding this hearing. The folks in Malheur County are good, honest, hardworking folks. It's a county that's economically struggling. If you understand the geography of where Malheur County is, it sits right on that eastern Oregon border where Idaho and Nevada compete with us every day for jobs, and it's a real struggle. I know Representative Bentz later today will share some of those thoughts with you, and I hope you'll listen to Representative Bentz because you cannot find a better voice for Malheur County than he. Want to let you know that Malheur County Economic Development stands ready to work with the state of Oregon to protect our natural resource partners, our farmers, our cattlemen, our onion producers, and all of our small business owners. Greatly appreciate you having this informational hearing. Rep. Clint, takes a lot of leadership to do this, and I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll really take to heart what those folks from back home have to share with you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Smith. And I know you've got another meeting to get to.
So.
So I am going to move now to the other part, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board overview, and ask Renee Davis and Eric Hartstein to come on up, and this other gentleman.
Eric Williams,
and join us. And committee members, this is something I often see. Well, there's a few ways and means folks here, but typically we hear a lot about agency mission and what they do in ways and means. We often don't do as much of that in our policy committees, and I thought it would be good for us to hear about this one in particular, and in particular today, because their basic, so far what I've seen at least, method of operation is to try and work collaboratively with landowners on projects to, you know, protect and restore watersheds. And so I wanted us to hear about how this particular agency works and how they do business. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Renee Davis, Deputy Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, or OWEB. We really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you about the agency and give you a sense of some of the types of investments that we make around the state in, exactly as Chair Clem said, voluntary restoration and conservation. I do want to send the regrets of our executive director, Maida Lofsgaarden. She's not able to join you today, but again, sends her regrets and is happy to follow up upon her return to the country. She's in Norway right now. So I'll begin with an overview about the agency, giving you a sense of some of the historic context and beginning to give you a sense of the budgetary investment areas that the agency has. Then I'll turn it over to Eric Williams, who is the agency's grant program manager, and he'll talk more specifically about the different investment areas. And then Eric Hartstein will talk with you about a new program that OWEB has launched, the Focused Investment Partnerships Program. So OWEB is a state agency that provides grants to help Oregonians around the state complete voluntary restoration and conservation work. So through this grant making, OWEB achieves its mission of helping to protect and restore healthy watersheds and natural habitats.
Before we go any further, I just need to acknowledge something. We have a doctor in the room. Representative Gilliam was just awarded an honorary doctorate. It's a doctor of laws. from Warner Pacific. So if everybody could just kind of pay the full respect to the doctor. Yes, yes, thank you. Doctor. Oh, please, continue.
Thank you. Congratulations, by the way, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you.
So through this grant making, OWEB does achieve its mission. I do want to highlight for you, there are three components to the agency's mission. The first does focus on those environmental aspects of voluntary restoration, actions for clean water and healthy habitats around the state. The second and third pieces, though, are critically important. The second is an economic component. So OWEB's grants that are provided around Oregon do help to create jobs and also provide resources to purchase goods and services in local communities around the state. And recently, in the last few years, University of Oregon completed a study of what we call the restoration economy. So essentially how that influx of funding for voluntary restoration and conservation can impact local communities, in particular rural communities around the state. So a few short statistics from that U of O study. First is that for every $1 million of investment of OWEB funds in voluntary restoration, approximately 15 to 24 jobs are created in local communities. Another statistic from that study is that for every $1 of OWEB funding invested, more than 90 cents of that stays in local communities to purchase goods, services, products. So there certainly is an economic component to OWEB's investment. Finally, is that community piece. This is really an emphasis on local communities coming together to determine solutions to challenging natural resources issues that really work for them and their communities. So I want to give you a little bit of historic context about the agency. OWEB really did begin essentially as an idea, and that idea was that a focus on voluntary restoration and cooperative conservation could provide an alternative to what historically at times ultimately ended up in litigation and chronic disagreement about natural resource issues. So with that idea, the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board was created in 1987 to start a very small but important granting program to help support that restoration work around the state. At that time, on average, the board's biennial budget was about $500,000. So if we fast forward to 1998, ballot measure 66 was passed. So that essentially set up the program as we largely know it today. So it constitutionally dedicated 15% of lottery revenues to go for dual purposes, one, parks, and second, natural resources. So 7.5%, half of that 15% of dedicated lottery funding came to OWEB for distribution in the form of grants. One piece that I would flag is that Measure 66 was time limited. The intent was that the constitutionally dedicated lottery funds would sunset in 2014. So if you fast forward ahead just a few additional years to 2010, ballot measure 76 passed, and that did make permanent those constitutionally dedicated lottery funds. It also specifically noted that a single agency, OWEB, would distribute and oversee all of the grant funding associated with the measure 76 funds. So I want to take a moment here to mention that in addition to the constitutionally dedicated lottery funds, OWEB does receive funds from a diverse set of other sources to support restoration and conservation around the state. Two primary sources are through the National Marine Fisheries Service. They offer a competitive grant program, the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund program. Oregon competes annually for that and typically has competed quite well. We last year ranked the highest of all of the states and tribes that were eligible for those federal funds. Historically, that fund has made up about a third of the agency's budget. The second primary source of funding that I'll mention are the Salmon License Plate Fund. So on average, that's about $500,000 per biennium. And I'll note that during the 2015 session, the agency did work with Representative Gomberg to ensure that those salmon plate funds were directly attributed to on-the-ground projects in salmonid habitat areas. So before moving into some of the specifics of our grant programs, I do want to briefly mention the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. I know that Representative Witt is quite familiar with this. So back in 1997, the Oregon Plan was adopted, and it really has four primary tenets that have provided an integral part of the way that the agency is structured. So the first is that focus on voluntary restoration that I mentioned previously, taking action that's voluntarily decided upon in local communities and implementing restoration and conservation projects. The second piece is coordinating that with agency and tribal action, so making sure that there's a complementary role between the voluntary piece and the regulatory and agency component of work on the ground that improves watershed health and water quality. The third is strong scientific oversight, really ensuring that those two sets of actions on the left side of this slide are scientifically sound and technically feasible. And then the fourth tenet is also quite critical. It's the necessary monitoring to ensure that we are tracking how well those actions are working on the ground to improve watershed health and water quality, and giving us the ability to refine those actions through time to ensure hopefully quite good return on investment. So in terms of the specific budgetary programs under Measure 76, the first and by far the lion's share of our budget is focused on the grant program, and this does support those science-based restoration and other projects on the ground in local communities. Eric Williams will talk in much more detail about that shortly. I would mention, though, there is a small portion of our budget that's focused on operations, and that's really helping our agency to support the local delivery of those grants to groups around the state. So that's things like providing grant program oversight, managing a very large 17-member board that we have, conducting some of the necessary monitoring and tracking work that I mentioned. So that's a portion of the budget that, as Chair Clem mentioned, Ways and Means works through with us, but the majority of our funding is focused on the grant side. I do want to give you a quick glimpse into how OWEB is structured, though, to provide those support services. We're a small agency, 35 staff this biennium. Our organizational chart shows, I know it's a little bit difficult to see, but we have three primary sections within the agency. One is the grant management program. So really that front line, working with local communities and organizations around the state to implement the restoration and other types of grants that we offer. We do have six field representatives placed around the state, so they have much closer geographic access to those local organizations who are proposing projects and can work closely with them. We have a business operations section that in which sits the financial administration for the agency, so things like making grant payments, ensuring accountability of those grant investments that we've made through time, et cetera. And then finally, we have the technical services program, which really is focused on that monitoring of the restoration and other investments and the reporting out on those so that we have a good sense of what we are accomplishing through time. So in terms of how the grant program delivery works, OWEB has a few primary roles: soliciting for grants, reviewing applications, again, harking back to that scientifically sound foundation, and then helping to manage the various grant programs that we offer. We do the monitoring work. We also focus time on partnership development, and that's helping to really scout opportunities for leveraging funds among different funders and really maximizing the amount of funding that's available for that voluntary restoration work around the state. The other two roles within the grant program delivery are critical ones. Without them, we would not have a grant program to speak of. First are the local restoration partners. So these are the individuals and groups who are developing projects and putting them on the ground. Restoration, they're doing outreach in local communities, they're doing the monitoring work to track the results of those investments, and then they are also engaged in partnership development, but more at the local scale, putting together the right teams of folks to develop restoration projects that really work for landowners who want to engage in voluntary restoration. And then finally, our landowners and communities. Without their willingness to participate in the types of programs that OWEB funds, we, again, would not have OWEB as it's known today. So those local restoration partners are really critical to getting this work on the ground. We make grants to a number of different types of organizations: watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, tribes, land trusts, local jurisdictions, universities, and others. So you'll see that there's a big diversity in the types of groups to which we provide grants, and combined, they're able to hit on the various needs out there related to both restoration, but then also work such as monitoring and outreach. So before I turn it over to Eric to talk a little bit more specifically about the grant program, I just wanted to tie together that the voluntary restoration and conservation work that we fund really does connect up to a number of other agency programs. So when a landowner engages in a fish passage project, for example, to help open new miles that had been blocked previously, say by a non-functioning culvert, then that helps to address salmon recovery planning and implementation needs that you might hear about from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Conservation strategy, priorities associated with wildlife habitat, total maximum daily load, ag water quality program that you hear about through ODA, and then certainly integrated water resources strategy. So the voluntary work that we fund and in which landowners around the state engage really do connect up to a number of state priorities that connect various natural resources agencies. So with that, Eric.
Okay. Thank you, Renee. Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Williams. I'm the Grant Program Manager at OEB and appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Following on Renee's introduction, I'm going to focus on the larger proportion of our funds that are earmarked for grant programs. And our board, each biennium, adopts a spending plan that guides the investments that the board makes. And that spending plan is updated from time to time as new funds might come in or new programs are developed. In terms of the proportion of investments that the spending plan includes, this pie chart gives you a history of the program since its inception and how those grant funds have been allocated by program. The biggest chunk that you can see on that pie is for restoration acquisition grants, about 55%. And then the next three at around 11 or 12% are local capacity, monitoring, and technical assistance. And by technical assistance, what we mean is work that our local partners do to help landowners develop solutions for issues they're trying to address, as well as for engineering designs for structures or other facilities that need to be built to accomplish the restoration goals. There are a couple other ones, smaller chunks on this pie, that are no longer offered, such as assessment, research, or education grants, and those changes were a result of moving from Measure 66 to 76. The board also has adopted a long-term investment strategy, which looks at both the types of investments and how they're solicited for implementation. This pie graph looks at the current biennium spending plan in terms of how projects are solicited and programs are funded. And the biggest chunk there that you can see, the blue piece of the pie, is our open solicitation program. This is what people, I think, typically think of when they think about OEB grants. These are sometimes referred to as our regular grants, which fund those restoration, technical assistance, monitoring, and outreach activities on the ground in local watersheds. The other two, the red and the green, that are roughly equal size, 18 or 19%, the red one is our new focus investment program that Renee alluded to and Eric Hartstein is going to describe in some detail in a few minutes. And then the green is our operating capacity grants. And the next three slides will illuminate some of these for you. The piece of the pie that is our operating capacity investments, these support the operating costs of effective watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. We run a grant process with review to ensure that we have healthy operating capacity in these critical organizations that are really the link to the on-the-ground work that happens around the state to achieve watershed restoration. And I'll also note that Courtney Schaff, our capacity coordinator, is here today if there are questions at the end. For our open solicitation program, or our regular grants, this is the program that we fund all of these application types listed on the slide, the main chunk being restoration. What's critical to this process for us is through open solicitation, we have six regions in the state, and we have six regional review teams that provide a thorough technical review of each application and makes a recommendation to our staff that in turn provides a recommendation for our board to decide which projects to fund. And I think it's really because of that local input and review and fine technical review that there is a healthy respect for the decisions that the board makes at the end of the process. And finally, for our Focus Investment Program, which is again currently about 19% of our spending plan. About 2 years ago, our board embarked on a process to designate priorities for Focus Investment to try to make consolidated investments in an area that can achieve measurable progress towards ecological outcomes. And the board went through a public process to determine what those ecological priority areas would be around the state. And there are seven of them. One is aquatic habitat for native fish species. One is dry type forests, closed basin wetlands, sage grouse habitat, coho salmon habitat, oak savanna, and estuaries. We ran a solicitation program and opened up application for focus investments to partnerships that we call high-performing partnerships, which means that there are partnerships of local organizations that have a structure in place for decision-making, and they have a strategic action plan to guide the investments that they'll make to achieve their ecological goals. And through that solicitation program, we ended up funding, our board ended up awarding six focused investment partnership initiative awards just this past January. And I will turn it over to Eric to describe those focused investment partnership grants.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Eric Hartstein, Senior Policy Coordinator with OEB. So as Eric Williams just alluded to, the six FIP implementation awards were made by the board in January. And these are really multi-year efforts with clear benchmarks and outcomes. And so working roughly east to west, we have the Oregon model to protect sage grouse, which is a partnership of soil and water conservation districts that are working with landowners to voluntarily implement projects that benefit sage grouse. The Harney Basin Wetlands Initiative is located in a similar geography, and the partners there are seeking to develop a model for controlling invasive carp in Malheur Lake and improving aquatic health in Harney Basin Wetlands. The Upper Grand Ronde Initiative partners will be implementing restoration projects that will increase habitat quality and quantity for spring Chinook salmon, summer steelhead, and other native fish species in Catherine Creek and the Upper Grand Ronde River. The partnership implementing the habitat restoration for resident and anadromous fish in the Deschutes will be restoring the habitat conditions necessary for successful reintroduction of salmon and steelhead into 226 miles of historic habitat in Wychus Creek and the Metolius and Crooked Rivers. The Ashland Forest All Lands Restoration Initiative partners are creating habitat conditions that are close to the natural range of variability, and provide landscape resilience to mitigate the threat of severe wildfire in this dry type forest, while protecting fish and wildlife habitats, water quality, and the surrounding community from catastrophic fire. And finally, we have the partners involved in the Upper and Middle Willamette Mainstem Anchor Habitats Initiative. They'll be rehabilitating the Willamette floodplain and riparian forests while reconnecting the river to its historic floodplain and increasing channel complexity by working cooperatively with landowners along the Willamette River. Oops. Oh, there we go. So also as a part of the Focus Investment Partnership Program, OEB offers capacity building grants to partnerships looking to strengthen their existing partnerships and develop strategic action plans. And in January, the OEB board awarded FIP capacity building grants to these eight partnerships. And over the next 1 or 2 years, the capacity building grants will help provide resources to build these eight into higher performing partnerships that are implementing strategic projects at a landscape scale. I hand it over to Renee.
So I did want to spend just a moment or two speaking to the monitoring issue. So monitoring is a critical part of our work and cuts across all of our programs. So whether it's open solicitation, focused investment, or operating capacity. And the intent with the monitoring work is really to evaluate and report on the progress and outcomes from the watershed work that our grants support. So monitoring is a really critical underpinning from our perspective, so that not only can we speak and be accountable to the progress that's being made by those investments, but also so that we can learn from those investments and, again, be able to refine our programs through time as needed. So in this spectrum, you see there's, you know, a range from inputs to outputs to outcomes to impact. And I would highlight that transition space from outputs to outcomes. OWEB and many others have gotten really good through time at being able to speak to what we create, what are those outputs, how many acres of upland areas were treated through juniper removal projects in Representative McLean's district, or how many miles of fish habitat were opened thanks to a fish passage barrier removal project in Representative Witt's district. And that's great to be able to account from that standpoint around the outputs, but it's harder to get to what do you actually see in terms of change on the ground in ecosystems in which you're working. We have, though, begun to get at that question and those issues through many different types of monitoring, ranging from status and trends monitoring that we work through with agencies such as Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, to programmatic effectiveness monitoring, looking at a particular type of restoration activity over a larger landscape and determining, are we starting to see a shift in terms of process and function in that landscape, to things like project level monitoring to determine, are groups implementing as expected the projects that we're funding. So in total, this various collection of monitoring tools that we have in the toolbox is really helping us to move towards getting a better handle on those outcomes and, again, having the information we need to adaptively manage our grant programs through time. So thank you again for the opportunity to talk with you about the agency and our investment areas, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions for this panel? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. I noticed in your organizational chart that about 20% of your employees are on limited duration appointments. Could you speak to that for just a moment?
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg. So part of that is due to the funding sources that we have. So one example would be one of the partnership coordinator positions that is co-funded with Bonneville Power Administration. And historically, I would say, and some of the folks on Ways and Means could speak more clearly to this, there's been some hesitation about turning positions into permanent positions when there is a fund source that we as a state don't necessarily have control over. The same is true of some of the positions that are funded, at least in part, with Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds, those NOAA dollars. There's been some hesitation to transition those into permanent given the potential uncertainty in the future of the fund source.
Questions? So I like stories, and this was great. I know you have to describe at a high level things, but can you tell me a story of some project that is a typical example of what's great about collaborative restoration somewhere?
Who wants to take?
Maybe involving dams, maybe not.
Sure, we could do that. I was just reading a project completion report the other day about a project in the Willamette Basin. And on this small creek that historically had salmonid activity in it, but over time through land use practices and so forth, the condition of the habitat had deteriorated such that those species no longer used that area anymore. And over a long-term process, the local watershed council spent time working with a mixture of both public and private landowners to take a look at the situation and identify some common goals that people had for managing their lands, and developed a strategy to address the habitat issues, both by doing things like replacing culverts that were too small that ended up becoming perched so that it creates a drop in the stream so that the fish can't migrate upstream, and also by reintroducing large wood to the stream channel, which creates habitat and spawning gravels that the fish need to survive in that watershed. And through a mixture of our funds, some U.S. Forest Service funds, and some in-kind services from the local landowners, that group of people in the Watershed Council were able to successfully replace three of those stream crossings that were blocking passage and install habitat structures in nine locations. This one, that's not something that's really going to knock your socks off in terms of what happened in that watershed, but I brought that one up because it's fairly representative of the nature of these projects. They're really dependent on a local watershed council or soil and water conservation district leading and coordinating with the landowners in their watersheds, whether that's you know, federal land or private land, and coming together to design and build a solution. And providing the additional funds that would be needed, otherwise those projects wouldn't get done. And in this example, the private landowners were very happy with the results. It really allowed them to continue managing their properties the way that they wanted to, and they got the desirable improvements to the stream habitat that they're responsible for.
So I remember this was a long time ago now, more than 20 years ago, and I was a staffer at that time to a U.S. senator, and we went down to Coos County, where I grew up, actually, to have a watershed council meeting. And in this, there were a lot of people who used to not talk to each other at all, but they were instead on this watershed council together, getting along. It was sort of strange. I mean, it's weird. What's going on here? And at the time, there was a federal regulation that prevented public money from being spent on private land, even if it was to help with a, you know, a stream that went through both. You just couldn't do it. And I don't know if we long-term fixed it. That's my question. We actually sat there in Coos Bay at the little Hurry Back Cafe with a napkin and wrote out a new amendment to some bill that was moving right at the time to create these watershed partnership enhancement agreements or something like that anyway, and we got it attached to a rider, and that seemed to do the trick to allow, okay, the farmer couldn't afford it, but yet that was where the block happened to be. And so you're doing all this stuff downstream with a lot of money. It was doing no good, literally, because there was this one issue upstream, but you couldn't do anything about it. And so there was I think they maybe called it the Wyden Amendment eventually, and it sort of addressed that. But is that problem largely solved now?
Rep. Clem, members of the committee, I believe it is, and whatever you did or the group did,
somebody else
must have been
napkin.
Successful. And just to give you an example, using, again, wood structures in a stream, you have to get the wood from somewhere to build these structures, and they're pretty large logs. They have to be at least two times the active channel width of the stream, 1.5 to 2 times, and some of them are desired with root masses intact. And so that's not an easy product to procure in a lot of situations. So in many of these cases, we've got the Watershed Council's supporting partnerships with the U.S. Forest Service to donate the wood that goes on the private land to build the structures. That's a very common thing that happens. And I think in eastern Oregon or other parts of the state, really, where we've got a checkerboard pattern of ownership with federal and private lands, we have seen a lot of coordination of efforts there. If, for example, the BLM is treating Medusa Head on a piece of their land, some of the surrounding private lands there might be also working on the Medusa Head problem using OBEB funds or other funds so that they can tackle in larger blocks the problems that they're trying to address in the watershed.
And just as a brief follow-on, Chair Clem, I would say that that largely has been addressed, given that on any given project we see a mix of funds from NOAA's Restoration Center, from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services Partners Program, from Natural Resources Conservation Service and their various EQIP programs. So there is an enormous amount of potential for federal funding to be used on private lands, and I think that local groups such as watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts are really smartly and strategically blending and commingling those dollars to get the best possible projects that cover the largest area possible implemented on the ground throughout the state. And if you want any particular story, Eric Hartstein used to be a Watershed Council coordinator, so I'm sure he has many.
I won't go too much further because I have a lot of people here on the other topic, but I just wanted to ask about that one thing. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You talked about the blending and commingling of funds from various sources. Can you remind us the the jobs impact that that has on a lot of local economies?
Mm-hmm. I can. Chair Clem, Representative Witt. So per the University of Oregon study, on average, for every $1 million of OEB funding invested, approximately 15 to 24 jobs are created. We cannot guarantee that those are permanent positions, but nonetheless, they are temporary and very important influxes into local economies. And more than 90 cents of every $1 of OEB funding invested stays within the local communities for purchase of goods and services within those communities. So very important complement to local economies, in particular in rural areas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for this group? All right. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Sharing with us a little bit. Okay. Then I need to give... Oh, Brent, you made it from overflow to here. Okay. Thought I'd have to give you some transit time. So let's have our first panel come up. This is Tim Davis, Brent Fenty, Bob Reese, and John Sterling. Four chairs. So just for those in the audience, what we're going to do here is have two views. You know, we can call them opposing views if we want to, but two views, 30 minutes each. Might be different numbers of people on each view, but the time will be the same, 30 minutes each. And then Representative Benz, who represents that area also in between, is going to share a little presentation. So this is the kind of a proponents of a Waukee Canyon Lands proposal, and we want to hear about that, and then we'll have kind of response to that. So welcome. I know there's a lot of people here from the public as well. We thought if we did full public hearing, literally everybody would have 1 minute probably. So we decided to instead try and have sides represented by having panels that can take a little more time and can dialogue a little bit. So please get us started.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tim Davis. First off, I'd like to thank everybody for being here today to talk about the Oahe and why it is important to them. A little bit about myself. I was one of the last few born in Nyssa, Oregon, when there was still a hospital there. I was raised in Adrian, Oregon, with a Oahe right out my back door. I now live in Ontario, Oregon, with my wife and five children. I'm here today because I'm a Malheur County resident that supports protecting the Oahe Canyon lands of Oregon. My love for the Oahe started at a young age. The first time I went camping in the Oahe, I was 2 months old at our family's annual chucker camp. My family has been having this annual chucker hunt for nearly 40 years. We have had family as far away as Nebraska come to this in past years. In more recent years, we have spread my grandma, grandpa, and my uncle's ashes in the Oahe, their favorite places to recreate and hunt. As a child growing up, I had a view of the Oahe Mountains and Sucker Creek Canyon from my bedroom window. This is where the love of the Oahe started for me. From a young age till now, I have explored and researched this special place. I could speak about what I know is out there through my own studies and explorations. I quickly realized how rich this area is with history ranging from Native Americans to early settlements and a strong ranching heritage. The geology of this area is very complex and formed by the same hotspot that formed Yellowstone before the tectonic plates have moved east. There are many plants found no other areas in the world. The Oahe is home to an incredible wildlife with raptors, game birds, and big game that are known across the state. These are just a few of the many reasons I started a local grassroots group called Friends of the Oahe. I want to share my love for this place with others, as well as take care of this place through service projects and volunteering, so it remain amazing for the future generations. This love of the Oahe is something
I hope that we all have in common and something we can build on. Like some people in Malheur County, at first I was against the thought of any additional protection for the Oahe. There was a lot of misinformation as well as rumors that fuel people's fear about protection and change, things that many folks already are uncomfortable with. But over time, after spending so much of my life in this landscape and doing my homework about what protection would actually mean, I came to know this area needs and deserves protection. My hope for this place is for it to be protected from any industrial developments like mining, oil, and gas, and as well as future rapidly growing population nearby, while also protecting the rich history of this place, the way of life, including ranching. We need to look beyond the moment. We need to look at the think of the future. Not even 5 or 10 years from now. I'm talking 50 or 100. If we look at the past 100 years, the population growth in Malheur County and the counties surrounding the Oahe, these counties are Malheur, Oahe County, Idaho, Ada County, Idaho, Canyon County, Idaho, Payette County, Idaho. The population has grown from almost 38,000 in 1910 to almost 193,000 in 1960. And to nearly 647,000 in 2010. The area around the Oahe is one of the largest, fastest growing areas in the country. And for many places experiencing this growth, such as Boise, Idaho, it is only an hour drive or less from the Oregon's Oahe. So it is with my most urgent and sincere hope that we work together and protect the Oregon Oahe Canyon lands. I love this place. My family, friends, and neighbors love this place. This can be a protected landscape and a working landscape. Protecting this place now ensures we keep this land and the activities ranging from recreation to ranching the way it is for future generations to love and explore. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you, Chairman Clem and committee members for having me here today and the opportunity to talk about this important issue. My name is Brent Fenty. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Natural Desert Association, also known as ONDA. ONDA exists to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert with support from our over 5,000 members and supporters from across the state. I'm also a member of the Oahe Coalition, a coalition of numerous groups and thousands of individuals dedicated to ensuring the conservation of the Oahe Canyon lands for current and future generations. I'm going to take my time to talk a little bit about the proposal and hopefully provide some clarification on what the proposal actually means, as well as build a little bit on what Tim said. I think it's clear to all of us in this room that the Oahe Canyonlands is an area that's important to thousands of Oregonians from across the state. I kind of feel awkward being in this room because there are so many people in overflow right now. I know, somewhere between 150 and 200 supporters are here today to express their support for this place. I hope this hearing today helps Oregon build a path towards towards balancing various interests and providing clear direction to preserving an area that is a critical part of our cultural and our natural history. I personally grew up in Central Oregon, just outside of Tumalo, and have had the good fortune to spend a considerable amount of time boating, hunting, hiking, fishing on public lands throughout the region in this particular area. You've heard from Tim about some of the important values in the Oahe and the formative impact this area has had on many Oregonians, including myself. I'd like to add to what he had to say about these amazing values within the area briefly. Thanks to the unique geology in the region that Tim mentioned, the Oahe Canyonlands is home to more than 24 plant species found nowhere else on this planet. The area is also home to one of the largest populations of greater sage grouse in North America, one of the largest herds of California bighorn sheep in the country, the second largest concentration of raptors in the Intermountain West, as well as important habitat for a host of other wildlife species, including Rocky Mountain elk, mule deer, and pronghorn antelope. The water that creates the Oahe watershed is also a critical resource that should be protected. It provides a backbone for communities downstream and for the associated agricultural industry and recreational economy. The degradation of that system through industrial energy and or mineral development poses an ecological and economic threat to the region. Conservation, on the other hand, keeps this important area intact. As I mentioned earlier, the geologic resources of the Owyhee Canyonlands are world-class. The varied and impressive geological features in the river canyon and the surrounding uplands provide an important resource for research, education, and visitation. If you've ever floated or walked through the river canyon and the associated tributaries and uplands, places like Leslie Gulch, it leaves you with a sense of awe, wonder, and respect. And it often leaves first-time visitors with a sense of disbelief that they're actually in the state of Oregon. Like much of Oregon, white settlement began in this area more than a century ago and has left a rich history with notable sites such as the Birch Creek Ranch that are enjoyed by thousands of visitors each year. Such sites provide an important connection to our history and an understanding of events that have created the cultural foundation of our state and the region. Native American tribes have a much longer relationship to this region, and hundreds of archaeological and cultural sites, including rock art, such as petroglyphs, are a testimony to the tribe's long and continued connection to this region. We must all work together, conservationists, ranchers, tribal members, and elected leaders, to protect these sacred sites from defacement and looting and reinforce tribal rights to continued use of and access to these lands. Discussions about conserving the Owyhee Canyonlands are not new. News stories mention the area as a potential national park in the 1970s and 1980s. The Bureau of Land Management designated over 1 million acres of the region as wilderness study areas nearly 3 decades ago, and then later added another 1.1 million acres of lands with wilderness character to their assessments. President Clinton considered the Owyhee as a national monument. Representative Greg Walden drafted a bill in 2000 to make it a federally protected wilderness. While the Oregon side of the Owyhee Canyonlands is hung in the balance, Idaho's congressional delegation, led by Republican Senator Mike Crapo, protected Idaho's Owyhee Canyonlands as wilderness in 2009. There is no coherent case to be made that Oregon's side of the Owyhee is not deserving of similar protection. Over the past decade, members of the Owyhee Coalition have had hundreds of conversations and meetings and reached out, sometimes unsuccessfully, to stakeholders throughout the region. Building on what we understand to be the concerns and needs related to this important area, as well as decades of planning efforts by federal and state agencies, the coalition developed a legislative proposal to create a 2.5 million acre national conservation area encompassing 2 million acres of wilderness. The National Conservation Area, sometimes referred to as an NCA, would be a multiple-use landscape that can be tailored to local circumstances and help to address management priorities such as invasive species, fire, and ecological restoration. Wilderness would be designated pursuant to the Wilderness Act of 1964 and creates management certainty in the place of the uncertain wilderness study areas that exist today and which were never intended to be permanent. Wild and scenic river designations would protect the remarkable characteristics of rivers and creeks within the area. To be clear, such a designation does not eliminate current uses. For example, livestock grazing is a grandfathered use, and grazing levels would continue to be determined by the current grazing management rules and guidelines. Likewise, such designations provide continued ability to access and maintain grazing improvements already established in the area. The proposal also calls for a system of designated roads and trails for recreational access and other uses in the area. Administrative access like that required by state and federal land managers and grazing permittees would continue throughout the area. As is the case in much of eastern Oregon, it is clear that invasive species are and will continue to be a threat to the Owyhee. Ecological restoration provisions would be built into protections for the area as a way to develop and support creative approaches to ecological restoration to help reduce and prevent further impacts from invasive species and associated wildfire. Such provisions would provide a thoughtful and balanced approach that weighs the needs of recreational access in the agricultural community, which are clearly two of the most prevalent uses in the region. Despite many years of outreach efforts, there are a number of misconceptions about the proposal that I'd like to cover as well. It has been stated repeatedly by people concerned with this proposal that grazing would be impacted by the National Conservation Area or wilderness designation or ensuing management plan.
On the contrary, permanent protection for the Owyhee is an opportunity to ensure well-managed grazing continues and that threats to ecological health and forage from things like wildfire and invasive species can be meaningfully addressed. People who cherish the ability to access this amazing country developed this proposal. It was specifically designed to keep open roads needed to access and explore the area and will not significantly limit access as claimed by some. A friend of mine who was rafting the Owyhee River returned from a trip a few weeks ago. They were told by a shuttle service that Birch Creek Road, which accesses the major rafting takeout on the Owyhee River, would be closed next year under the proposal. It's simply not true. The Owyhee Coalition, which is made of hunters and rafters and hikers and fishermen, is committed to a road network that preserves access for recreation and other uses that support landscape conservation. There are some that argue no threats exist to this area, and I really wish that were true. Impacts from off-road vehicle use has been growing over the past few decades as users pour in from regional population centers such as Boise. Such areas are growing rapidly, and impacts will also continue to grow. Clear prohibitions on damaging cross-country travel and new road development are not put in place. Over 170,000 acres of oil and gas leases have been issued in the region in Malheur County over the past few years. A February 2014 article in Malheur County's Argus Observer newspaper was titled, quote, "County poised to be next hotbed for gas exploration." Two mining proposals, one for gold and the other for uranium, sit on the northern and southern end of the conservation proposal, respectively. Two large energy transmission projects have been proposed in the region. An area once protected by its ruggedness and remoteness is becoming increasingly less remote, and new technology has rendered ruggedness an ineffective defense against creeping industrial development. As you might imagine, a proposal for an area this special has engendered widespread support from people across the state. Today, results from a recent poll were released showing that 70% of Oregonians support the permanent protection of this area. In the 2nd Congressional District, covering most of eastern Oregon, support is at 66%. On the wildfortheowyhee.org website, you can also find testimonials of support from Oregonians all across the state who know, love, and want to see this important place protected for future generations. They are joined by more than 35,000 people who have signed petitions of support. I hope this area brings us closer to consensus on the protection of this important place. I hope it will help us finally focus on the facts of protection as opposed to misconceptions or decades-old disagreements. I truly believe that we can protect the ecological and cultural values in the Owyhee while honoring the needs and traditions of the agricultural and ranching community in Malheur County. In doing so, we can ensure that local economies are strong, a critical part of our state and natural heritage is preserved, and that we leave the Owyhee Canyonlands whole for our children and grandchildren and for those who come after us. Thank you again for your time and interest in this important issue.
Well, thank you, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the Owyhee Canyonlands, which is a landscape important to me, but also very important to
the... I just need to have you say your name for the record.
My apologies. John Sterling with the Outdoor Industry Conservation Alliance. A landscape that's important to me personally, but also very important to the future of Oregon's outdoor recreation economy. I'm the executive director of the Outdoor Industry Conservation Alliance, and we're a group of about 200 outdoor industry companies that work together to ensure that wild lands and waters are protected for their recreation benefits. Our member companies make the outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear that their customers need to enjoy adventures in our great outdoor landscapes. Our founding members created the Conservation Alliance out of a shared belief that our industry needed to do more collectively to ensure that wild places are protected. I often say that our creation was an act of enlightened self-interest. Our founders and the members that have come after them believe that certain places have inherent conservation values, but they also know that protecting these places benefits their business. The Conservation Alliance strongly supports the strongest possible protection for Oregon's Owyhee Canyonlands. You mentioned earlier you like stories. I want to share a story with you that exemplifies the value, the recreation value of Oregon's Owyhee country. Last month, I had the good fortune to spend 4 days floating the Owyhee River from Rome to Birch Creek, a trip that I'd done before but hadn't been able to do for several years because of low flows in the river. The Owyhee River is on the bucket list for many river enthusiasts because it's remote, it's spectacularly beautiful, and it's sometimes elusive. Whitewater rafters have a short window of time each year to run the Owyhee because the snowmelt flows freely through the dam-free section of the river until it hits Owyhee Reservoir. Once the snow is gone, the rafting season ends. When we arrived in Rome in early April, the boat launch was crowded with groups from Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and elsewhere. Snowfall in previous winters had been thin, forcing many commercial and private trips to cancel their plans. But this year was different. The snowpack was deep, and normal temperatures ensured a steady flow of water through the canyon from all throughout April and into May. The pent-up demand to float the Owyhee River in Oregon was clear, as boaters from throughout the West joyously prepared their rafts for their memorable adventure. Our mostly Oregon-based group included friends from Utah, California, and Colorado, most of whom had never seen southeastern Oregon. As a native Oregonian, it is satisfying to see the effect one of our most spectacular landscapes has on visitors from out of state. Throughout the trip, our pals used a lot of superlatives. They called it iconic. They said it was national park quality. They'd never seen anything like it. Indeed, there is nothing quite like Oregon's Owyhee Canyonlands, which is why we need to protect it today so that future generations have the opportunity that we have to enjoy this singular place. Outdoor recreation is an important economic driver. According to a study by the Outdoor Industry Association, outdoor recreation nationwide generates $646 billion in direct consumer spending each year. In Oregon alone, outdoor recreation generates $12.8 billion in spending and supports 141,200 jobs. And our recent trip to the Owyhee provides a good illustration about how those numbers add up. First, retail sales. You need to buy a lot of gear to enjoy a trip on the Owyhee, and over the years I'd supported many outdoor brands by purchasing the equipment and clothing that I needed for my four-day trip. My tent, my sleeping bag, river sandals, a life jacket, headlamp, and batteries. Before the trip, we bought groceries and other trip supplies. To get to the river, we drove from Bend to Rome, filling our gas tank in Burns along the way. We met our friends at the Rome station where they were just finishing a hearty diner breakfast. We paid a Malheur County resident to shuttle our cars to the takeout at Birch Creek. Every step of the way, outdoor recreation trips like ours pump money into the economy, and this is a sustainable source of revenue. All we have to do is protect the goose that lays the golden egg. Outdoor recreation expenditures on protected public lands benefit local communities. According to several studies conducted by Headwaters Economics, protected federal land in the West, wilderness areas, national parks, national monuments, are important economic assets that attract people and businesses as well as new jobs and income. Tourists, entrepreneurs, and retirees alike are drawn to places surrounded by protected public lands. Tourists spend their vacation money, but this is not just a seasonal benefit. Businesses move to communities surrounded by public lands. We have many member companies that will tell you they located in communities in Oregon because of the amenities offered by nearby protected public lands. And those amenities contribute to a high quality of life that helps businesses attract and retain good employees. And retirees bring their life savings to spend in their golden years on these public lands communities. In 2012, Headwaters Economics released a study that found that the West's protected public lands offer its businesses a competitive advantage, a major reason why the Western economy has outperformed the rest of the U.S. economy. A big part of this economic benefit comes because protecting a place puts it literally on the map. Protecting the Owyhee Canyonlands will give the area a luster that invites people to visit,
and explore. It would give local communities and statewide agencies like Travel Oregon something to promote. Travel Oregon's recent Seven Wonders of Oregon campaign increased visitation at Smith Rock State Park by 14%, but in Crater Lake by 18%, and at the Painted Hills by 50%. Recreation and economic development aside, protecting the Owyhee Canyonlands is the right thing to do. As Oregonians, we pride ourselves on our rich outdoor heritage. We rightfully brag about our diverse collection of protected landscapes, from our state beaches to our mountain wilderness areas in the Cascades, the Ochocos, and the Wallowas, and to our desert gems like Steens Mountain. But while we brag, our neighbors protect. Idaho has protected 9% of its state as wilderness. Washington has protected 10%, California 15%. Oregon is taking up the rear at 4%. It's time for Oregon to make the same commitment to protecting our special lands that our neighbors have, not just for the sake of keeping up, but because these protected places are an important investment in our economic future. The Oregon legislature has a rich history of leading on conservation and recreation issues. Your predecessors created the State Parks and Recreation Department in 1921, and this body has overseen the growth and funding of the best state park system in the United States. The Beach Bill in 1967, the Bottle Bill in 1971, the Land Conservation and Development Act in 1973, all pioneering efforts by the Oregon legislature. Though you have no official jurisdiction over the federal lands in the Owyhee Canyonlands, your voice matters to our members of Congress and to the Obama administration, who are in the position to give this special place the protection it deserves. I ask that you resolve to support the effort to secure permanent protection for the Owyhee Canyonlands. Thank you.
Five minutes and 20 seconds.
Perfect. I'll be shorter. Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is Bob Reese. I'm a 20-year veteran fishing guide, a sixth-generation Oregonian, and the executive director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. My family worked in the wool industry in Chanticleer, Oregon, and I have a unique draw to Eastern Oregon as well. It's where I put in my hunting tags. I waited for 11 years to put in for a hunt over in that area, and maybe I'll get lucky and draw this year.
I'm still waiting for bighorn sheep. It could be forever, yeah. I think.
Once in a lifetime draw. Yeah. Even though that I grew up in Northeast Portland, it was my grandfather in Pennsylvania that taught me to love the outdoors. That love for the outdoors was so strong that I was pricing motorhomes in the first grade, anxiously awaiting to get my driver's license to move to Pennsylvania so I could live out the rest of my days fishing and hunting. Thankfully, it wasn't long after that that I discovered all that Oregon had to offer the outdoorsman. Since then, I've spawned a seventh-generation Oregonian, my daughter, also destined to love the outdoors, when I can talk her out of dance lessons, hopefully in the near future. But she's got a good foothold in the fishing and hunting community. Fishing and hunting is much different now than it was when I was growing up. What used to be open to public access is often closed and sold to private outfitters that sell their hunts for a premium price. Those of us that are run-of-the-mill outdoorsmen can't quite justify the $3,500 to $5,000 hunts that take place on these private lands. We are losing public access, and with that, our ability to enjoy the natural resources of this state. Additional long-term protections for the Owyhee Canyonlands help ensure a productive landscape for fish and wildlife resources for both the consumptive and non-consumptive user. While fishing and hunting licenses are flatlining, non-consumptive wildlife viewing is thriving. And as Oregon's population grows, so will the demand to explore wild and unique areas of the greatest state in the Union. As you're well aware, funding for ODFW is on shaking ground, and growing this economy is the future of Oregon. I just came from Casper, Wyoming, to comment on BLM's federal coal leasing program. And while coal is king in Wyoming, Oregonians are clearly choosing to use our lands differently here for a sustainable future for fish and wildlife, while protecting the existing uses of the stakeholders that already utilize these lands. Our goal as a coalition is to work together for the benefit of all future generations of Oregonians. These lands are unique in Oregon, and we should protect them and treat them as such. Thank you.
2 minutes to spare. Okay, so let's do questions here for a little bit, and then we'll have Representative Bitts come and talk, and then we can always call you guys back up after the other side goes for a while if we have more questions. But we've got some time to do questions now. So, Mr. I'll give the vice chair the priority to get in first. Then
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I think this question would be best for Brent. Polling. As I've been studying the situation, the polling has been fascinating. So today, I live here in Kaiser, so we get the Statesman Journal, and this was in my newspaper today. It is a full-page ad taken out by Owyhee Canyon Lands Coalition, mm-hmm. but it's the poll that you were talking about. So Oregonians say protect the Owyhee, 70% statewide support permanent protection, 66 in Eastern Oregon's 2nd Congressional District. And, you know, I don't have any doubt that that poll is true. What I want to ask about is there was a poll that was done earlier, because the situation is, do we want to protect it, or do we want the President of the United States to say protect it versus the people of Oregon? And a poll that was very clear, 73% said they wanted Congress, not the President. So that would be the people through Congress. That was in Multnomah County, 69%, and the rest of Oregon, 74%, were in favor of Congress, not the President. So you can see where I'm, and by the way, the next part of the poll said that 57% of the people in Oregon, all over Oregon, said they wanted the locals to make this decision, not the President of the United States. So that's my problem, is good, bad, great, whatever, all these proposals, wonderful, but do we want the President of the United States, whom I'm sure, as Representative McClain said this morning, is probably watching us this morning, and I'm sure he's thrilled about it. Was that you?
That was me who said
okay.
It. I'm sure he's taking notes.
I'm sure he's watching this. Yeah. But do we, you know, shouldn't the people who live there, and you live there, Tim, shouldn't the people who live there make this kind of a decision, or at least have a larger say via whether it be Congress, or I doubt the Oregon legislature will be involved in this, but that's my concern. People are saying, I don't want the President making this decision. I want it to be a decision of the people.
Thank you for the question, Representative Post. I mean, I think there's a lot of layers to that question, so let me see if I can hit them in short order. Is one, I think it's really important that all of us in this room remember we are talking about public lands. They are owned by all Oregonians, all Americans. We all have a responsibility to engage in a process to figure out what the future of our public lands are. I think you heard from all four of us. You know, we all, it sounds like, grew up in similar households where hunting, fishing, getting out on public lands was something that defined our experience as Oregonians, and I think that's not unique in this state. This, you know, this is an area that is cherished by Oregonians. As you acknowledge, it doesn't surprise you that 70% of Oregonians would say this area deserves some sort of protection. How you do that is always the challenge. I think asking an open-ended question about whether the President or Congress or locals should have more say in designating an area is less an indication of how people feel about protecting the area and more about what their comfort level is with this President or our Congress or, you know, neighboring communities, you know, having a veto authority on protection. So I think we need to be very careful in interpreting questions like that. You know, I think in terms of polls, I mean, all of you are elected officials. You've all, I'm sure, run polls in the past. I think it's important how those polls are, how the questions are asked in those polls. And I think, you know, you always are working to get objective questions answered so you get the best sense possible of what public opinion truly is. You know, I don't, mean to be, you know, disrespectful of the other poll, but when I read it, I would note, you know, the following question, you know, that you didn't note is, it says, Oregonians believe a new 2.5 million monument area isn't needed and goes too far. Well, if you read the question, it asks the question after saying that there are already seven layers of protection and regulation, and then says, well, what do you think, you know, should we give it more protection? I think that's a rather leading question myself. So I think we need to be careful. I would also note in terms of that poll, you know, you can characterize this, you know, another one says by 3-1, Oregonians believe a new national monument area would make life worse, not better. Well, it also says what's left out of that is, you know, over, you know, the same amount of people who say it'd be worse say it wouldn't have any effect on the local economy and local communities. So I don't want to go back and forth on the polling. I think, you know, what I would like to emphasize in this is all voices are really important, and I think we all are clear. I live in Deschutes County. 78% of my county is publicly owned. Do I maybe have a little more influence in public land management because it's in my backyard? Certainly I do. I can walk out my backyard and talk to a land manager and share my concerns instead of driving 5 hours to talk to a land manager in the Vail District, BLM. But we all have a responsibility to work together and figure out where the common ground are on these issues, figure out if we agree that this is an area that's important for future generations, what is the appropriate form of protection, rather than just saying no to any form of protection and leaving the question closed at that.
Oh, Representative McClain.
Thank you. Brent, you've stated that there is a battle of the polls going on, yet you represented to this committee that 70% or something like that of Congressional District 2 folks want this designation. So it strikes me as disingenuous to, on one hand, disregard a poll that seems contrary to your point when trying to base your points on your own polling. Donald Trump's 2 points above Hillary Clinton, according to Washington Post. Are you prepared to say Donald Trump is wanted by the people of the United States at this point? In other words,
is that a question?
Well, my point. Well, sure.
Yeah.
You come in here relying on polling to say that the local people want it, and then you disregard contrary polls.
I'm not.
You also indicated that there were misrepresentations going on, or, you know, forgive me, but if you say, hey, I'm an environmentalist, trust me, well, guess what? I don't.
Right.
Okay? Because my constituencies have not been treated fairly by the environmental community. So when you say, hey, this isn't going to shut down this road, this isn't going to cause grazing problems, et cetera, and oh, by the way, 70% of the people want it, and then disregard other polls. I mean, how do I legitimize your testimony based upon your disregard so cavalier of contrary views?
Representative McClain, I want to be clear, and I think I was clear. I'm not disregarding the poll. I'm simply saying that the polls are not the basis for which we have these conversations. And yeah, we can go back and forth about different poll questions. You know, I understand the long history of mistrust in Eastern Oregon. You know, I grew up in Central Oregon. I had friends and family during the Spotted Owl, you know, conflict that, you know, lost, you know, jobs pulling green chain at the mill or driving truck. None of us in this room who've been around this state and call it home are unfamiliar with that history. But what I am saying is that I think we shouldn't let that history define the issues that we're working on today. And will that trust happen overnight? No, it won't. But it certainly won't happen if we don't get in the room and figure out what we agree on and what we just simply have to agree to disagree on. That, to me, will represent the foundation of any long-term solution to this issue. And that's what I was, you know, suggesting and proposing, is simply that the polls themselves do not tell us the answers that we're looking for. They will not offer us the answers we're looking for. Do they provide us a sense of where general public opinion is? Yes. But I was simply making the point that, you know, I think we need to come together on these things and not rely specifically on the polls. So
may I
follow up? Yep.
Have you ever talked to a family that has to choose between whether the parents skip meals so their kids can eat so they can buy fuel at the end of the month? Have you ever sat down and talked to a family like that?
You know, Representative McClain, I'm one of those families. I didn't grow up wealthy. I grew up outside of Central Oregon on a small ranch. You know, yes, I know that family. That family, I'm part of that family. So, you know, I know exactly what it's like.
Well, then you know the frustration that comes when parents are having a hard time making a living and feeding their kids, and they themselves skip meals so their kids can eat. Because guess what? That still happens, and it happens in districts like mine, in districts like Representative Bentz. And so it is much more than just folks coming together and trying to understand what could be beneficial to sportsmen who live in Representative Helms' district. It's real.
I agree it is real. And I can tell you, as someone who grew up in Central Oregon and didn't have unlimited resources, public lands were something that offered me an opportunity that otherwise wouldn't have been available to me if I had to pay $3,500 a hunt. My family grew up hunting, fishing all over Eastern Oregon. It's the public lands that afforded me that opportunity. And I don't intend or want that opportunity to be taken away from anyone.
Well,
and
that's by advancement of such a massive designation in the name of wanting to provide access. The question that hasn't been presented here is, what has the status quo done to deny you and people situated like you from access to public lands and recreation at this point?
What has the status quo been? I don't believe I understand your question.
I think that's the point, isn't it? That when a contrary view comes up, you either don't understand or you reject.
Let's try and clarify the question.
Yeah,
what he means is, given we saw a lot of photos of people recreating, what's so wrong with the current law that they seem to be able to go out there and recreate?
Thank you for the clarification. The laws right now do not protect this area as it is at the moment.
The question I asked was access. Because protect can be a lot of things. Protect in your view. I ask the question, what is the access status quo that you reject?
I think the access status quo that I reject is cross-country travel willy-nilly across a landscape that is obviously fragmenting an area, exposing it to invasive species, which create an opportunity for fire and other issues. Unrestricted kind of access, you know, into areas that, you know, are very sensitive and, you know, need the protections that from activities like oil and gas, from mining that threaten to cut up this area and therefore impact the enjoyment that, you know, anyone that has historically accessed that area, you know, has had. Access, you know, the impacts that will degrade wildlife populations that provide opportunities for hunting. So I hope that starts to get at your question.
So we're going to take a pause for a second because while I know you represent a good part of Middle, we've got a gentleman over there who would like to talk from
I'm
going to
finish up this. I want to finish up this.
I'm worried we're going to cut into time.
So what I make sure is you're saying invasive species, fire, and enjoyment. So enjoyment will be diminished if status quo is continued. That will more likely have fire threats if status quo is continued, and that invasive species will increase if we maintain status quo.
And, you know, you're a hunter, I believe, right?
Yes.
So, you know, if you have declining wildlife populations because you have a bunch of new roads and you have oil and gas development or energy transmission, I would imagine there's a lot of different activities that would reduce your ability to use or access your public lands in that area.
So declining wildlife, is there any
fish, wildlife, etc.?
Okay, so we got to stop now. We will come back. We will have you come back. But I've got all these ranchers who want to talk to.
Yep.
So I want to manage time here. So Representative Bentz, can you join us? Thank you all. I'll have you come back up at the end, but I want to hear the other side from the folks who came back. They shoot me.
I think they were enjoying my question.
I know, but they want to talk to, I think. And so, and Senator, can you?
I'll let you.
And please, Senator. Welcome,
Mr. Chair.
Both of you. Thank you.
I'm Cliff Bentz, State Representative from District 60, and very much appreciate you holding this hearing on this important issue. My family and my friends and many of my clients are here today knowing full well they won't get to testify, but this issue is so incredibly important. They've made the 7, 8, 9, 10-hour trip, taking a couple of days to be here to listen to this this presentation. The goal, of course, is that at the end of this exercise, after they visited with different people in this building, state representatives and senators will write to our president or write to our governor or somehow contact those who have some ability to weigh in on this issue and say, look, a monument is the wrong thing to do. We all want to protect this land. A monument is not the right way to do it. This next slide, I think, illustrates so I can figure out how to make this. There we go. This slide I put together between other law-related matters over the last week, and I've got this little pointer here to show you some of the things that actually have been talked about already. This is the Boise area. Ontario is right here. This area here, this in outlined in red, that's the area that people want, ONDA wants to make into a monument. This is the Owyhee Reservoir right here. Jordan Valley is right here. These are highways that zoom down to Nevada and more quickly as a result of our new speed limit law. There are roughly 750,000 people right here, and they're about 3 miles away from the edge of the proposed monument. 3 miles. Now, why do I point this out? It's because that indeed it's 60 miles down to Three Forks. By the way, I hope I don't put somebody's eye out with this, but I grew up right over here, right there on the White Horse Ranch. My granddad came to this area about 100 years ago. I know this area extraordinarily well, not as well as many of the people in the room, but really well. And I just can't tell you how huge this space is. Most of it over here, by the way, nowhere close to here's the canyon here, see it? But look at this huge space out here, bigger than many of our states, so at least two of them. Why would we stamp the word monument all over this so that we can suck a whole bunch more people into it? Why would we do that? Why would we? We heard a few minutes ago Brent saying he wants to protect the land. Then another one of the people testifying said, but we can sell so much stuff as people clomp down there and walk around it. I'm going, what? What? So if we're going to protect this land, let's do it right. A monument by our president is not the right way. I'll tell you that right now. Why? Because right over here is the Steens Mountain. It was done in a collaborative effort to avoid a monument designation. We're still having huge difficulties in the interface between people and that area, that important space in eastern Oregon. And we did a lot of things right over here. Let's not do them wrong here and make this basically a waste ground for people tromping around on it and across it. Let's get it right. And I just want to show you, because look at this. I was always thought this was a bit odd that which had the proponents have created this map. They don't say a word about this monster huge herd of people right here. A strange oversight. I want to show you, there's Boise, Idaho. Guess most of you haven't been there. It's a big town, and it's growing bigger rapidly. So it's time to get this right. These are some of the layers of, God bless America. This is some of the layers of protection already in place. There's been statements that this land is not protected. That is not true. This land is so protected that nothing has happened on it for about 150 years. That's how protected it is. The key is trying not to invite thousands of people in to make it less protected than it has been. I want to go through and show you again. Keep in mind this huge area, 60 miles wide, because that's the width of Malheur County, about 120 miles long. I think the area stretches, if it was here in the Willamette Valley, from Portland clear down to Reedsport and then over to Eugene and back. That's how big this area is. Huge. What we ought to do is come over here and say, hey, let's make this a monument. Move out. Okay, this is the area. These are existing wilderness study areas inside the monument designated portion. Each of these WSAs, each of these, has been carefully designed through the NEPA process. Now, you might say, well, this is so huge that probably the people, the BLM doing this, didn't get out in this area, or it'd be in that WSA spot area too. But no, they studied all this, and these were the areas that deserved this layer of protection. Not these areas, but somehow, because they didn't get it the way they wanted to begin with, the current proponents are busy kind of roping all the rest of this stuff in. Odd. This is the, excuse me, the ONDA proposal. There's the wilderness study area. Here's the sage grouse. This layer of protection means that you can't do much of anything where there is core areas. Those are the ones in brown. All of these areas you can't do much at all now because, well, that's where the sage grouse are. And then the low-density areas, those are also protected because of the grouse and all of the work we did on a collaborative basis to avoid the listing. Huge amounts of collaboration to make it so that we could get along with the grouse and still stay out there. This is one of the things I just heard that just floors me. This area here in yellow, this is already a wild and scenic river. That designation's already in place. Okay, now right about here is where everybody's putting their rafts in and floating down the river. That's not going to go away. That protection already exists. So what does all this talk about having to, you know, freeze it in place? It's already been frozen in place. Why would we add another layer? This is existing Wild Horse and Burro Act. And by the way, as an aside, the wild horses are doing the environment no favors. Just so you know, I hate to attack my friend Flicka, but the point is, these horses out here, they are running around and they're trashing sage grouse and everything else that gets in the way. But guess what? Those protections are there.
Thanks.
This is the areas of critical environmental concern. They're already in place. This is the area that's already in the process of being withdrawn from any type of mining or gas exploration. See all these areas here? That already is in place. It hasn't happened permanently, but I'm thinking probably will. And it's 10 years frozen in place. By the way, nothing's happened out here for 30 years because our current processes are so incredibly challenging. That's why the large area right in this area here that is an existing Superfund cleanup site because the mercury mining that goes on in this area did years and years ago. Has stopped. Now that happens to be where there is, one of the United States' largest deposits of uranium. Nothing's going to happen there because our mining restrictions are so great. And up here is where my brother, former Malheur County Sheriff Adney Bence, has been trying for years to get a gold mine going. Still hasn't succeeded. We have high hopes. Didn't happen very fast. This is the Endangered Species Act. Oddly enough, it covers that entire area, in fact, the entire area. There's the FLIPMA, it covers the entire area. There's NEPA, it covers the whole area. In fact, it was under NEPA that the areas that are now WSAs were developed. Clean Water Act, it covers all the area. Of course, there's not much water down there, but it covers it. Now, these CCAAs, these were what ranchers entered into almost 1 million acres of ground in these areas, almost 1 million acres of ground in Malheur County that are hand in glove with these Canada conservation agreements that have been worked out in a way to try to make the public land work better with the private. If we put these permits, these grazing permits on this huge area at risk, much of that private land protection may dwindle. Finally, I want to show you, there's the current layers of protection over the whole thing, kind of all, and somebody to say that we don't have protection, that is ridiculous. I stack these all up, kind of show you all the protections. This is one that makes all the people here in this, the reason all my colleagues, friends, family, everybody else are here is because of this top one. Litigation opportunity funding by Access to Justice Act arising from each planning, and it should be each law. Each one of these laws gives a foundation for litigation. Each one. And I think there'll be someone who will testify to the number of times that ONDA has filed suit. If the monument is put in place, another layer of litigation, another chance for ranchers to try to figure out how in the world to stay in business while paying lawyers to do so. This layer of protection here is the time it takes for the BLM planning process to work. That's a layer of protection because, by God, it takes a long time. Why? Because they're so busy planning for litigation. This reminds me, by the way, of something my law school professors used to say. When you're not sure of something in court, bring another Bible in. Have people swear on two Bibles instead of one. Maybe six, maybe eight, maybe 12. That'll make the land so much more protected. You know, that's pretty much all I have, other than to say this. The most important thing for protection of land is that we all work together to do it. Bringing in this monument is a declaration of defeat. It's we give up on trying to work this out. Let's just bring a pencil in, make it a monument, make it so, by God, everything will be fine. That's not true. The best way to protect our land is to work together. You're going to hear about that from the other folks that drove all the way up here. I truly urge each of you to write a letter to our president, to our governor, to our U.S. senators, and say, for God's sakes, not a monument. If we need more protection, let's do it right.
Senator.
Thank you, members of the committee and Mr. Chair, for the opportunity just to add a little to my colleague's presentation. If you look at the history of the area, of the entire east side of the state of Oregon, and go back to a period of time when cattle and horse and sheep grazing was relatively unrestricted, you could find a point in about 1912 or 13 where there were more than a million head of sheep, cattle, and horses in that eastern Oregon region. Along about the 1914 through 1918, those areas were depopulated by the national requirement to feed troops in World War I. Subsequently, people took a strong interest in managing grazing, and that led to the 1934 Taylor Grazing Act, which significantly and for the first time added a layer of administrative review and permitting processing that didn't previously exist. The population of livestock in those areas is less than 10% of its historic high. And today we do have multiple agencies, jurisdictions, and layers of management, state, federal, local. And I just commend my colleague, Representative Benz, for bringing the graphic to your attention that shows the layers and levels of protection that are there. Just to point out also, 90% of the acreage in Malheur County and Harney County are federally managed. So there's literally a small percentage of private land in these communities that can be used by citizens to try to have an economic life. So, you know, 10% of the total of 10,000 square miles in one county's case and 10,000 square miles in the other county's case, Harney and Malheur, 90% of those acres are already subject to the one of the highest levels of management and permitting requirements that you can put on land. It really is a struggle now to find arable land that isn't going to be subject to 500 kilovolt lines crossing them, or somebody from Washington, D.C.'s inspiration about how much more protection they can proffer at a destination at the end of the Oregon Trail, which is great copy. You know, it's fabulous in terms of how it polls and the emotional appeal that you can make. But in point of fact, it won't help the local community pay for its schools, roads, emergency services, that the tourists that will go out there, who will find no motels and no tourist facilities, will need in case they run their four-wheeler into a ditch. All volunteers, I might add. The point is, sustaining the community is the challenge out there, not finding additional levels of protection for land. If it were necessary to add additional levels of protection, I'd simply invite the committee to ask the county commissioners from Malheur and Harney County to come here and present the plan that they've been looking at for a decade. So if additional protections or additional designations are needed, there's a local plan that has broad base of support. Nobody's even inquired about. So all I will tell you is that this proposal for an executive order is a great public relations ploy. It is guaranteed to polarize Oregonians. It pits urban against rural. It's a cheap environmental vote. I frankly think our challenge today as legislators for the state is to figure out how rural communities can become more sustainable. And if you think creating destinations by circling, by making a circle on a map will help, I would ask you to look at all the timber-dependent communities that were told that tourism and recreation would completely replace the forest products industry manufacturing jobs that used to be prevalent in rural communities. Never happened. You know, the Wilderness Society basically 25 years ago told rural Oregonians, move or starve. And they've been doing everything they can to make that the only choices that Oregonians and rural communities have. We don't need another designation. I think Representative Pence is made this the single most salient argument. This land is already protected. We simply do not need an executive order. It will harm the communities. Thank you, members.
Thank you. And we're going to get to this next group that came over in just a second. I am going to ask Representative Springer really quick, really, really quick, to come on up. Thank you. I do want to say to Representative Bentz, and to those of you who are here from Malheur County in particular, you know, those of us who live over here certainly noticed some event that happened last summer, and I particularly noticed Representative Bentz when I read in the paper him letting people know that taking over things with guns is not the ideal way to make change, and that while there are legitimate frustrations for people, this is the way to be heard versus other things, and that was courageous because I'm sure that was not popular among everybody out there. But Cliff, in particular, noted, I hope tonight is, this is a town hall meeting out there, I hope tonight is a affirmation of the hard work of government, not the siren song of a gun. And so I hope those of you who were tempted by the siren song realize there are people who represent the west side of the state. We don't act in a partisan fashion, this committee. We've never had a party line vote out of here. We do listen and we do care about the challenges of having most of your land owned by the federal government, which happens over here too in Douglas and Coos counties. But that this is the way we try and deal with problems versus other methods, which people out of frustration sometimes do. But I wanted to at least acknowledge that there needs to be a venue to talk. Otherwise, you end up with people wanting to take over things because they're not heard. Well, this is that venue. And so after Representative Springer goes quickly, you will be heard. Please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. Frankly, that's on this side of the mountain. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Just a couple comments and maybe a question that I'm grappling with and I offer to you to grapple with. And that is, there's lots of facts. I have them here on my phone. I could talk about them. I'm not going to. You've already had a great PowerPoint presentation that's not going to be one-upped by Representative Bentz. But I think this might be, as I hear both sides of this issue, this is an issue of control. And who should control? And I'm hearing that locals should control. But it's interesting. I hear a couple different definitions of local. Anybody in Oregon is a local versus somebody that lives in the area, which I tend to think of as local. I find it interesting that the true locals were bused many hours to be here to talk about their local issue. And as I've heard, and so why do I care about this? Because I think this is maybe a step, actually, I don't think maybe. This is clearly a step one, or however you want to sequence that, in other steps and other monuments. So I think that we need to be extremely careful how we move forward from this point, because I don't think this is the beginning and the end. I think it's the beginning. And so as I look at that, and there's even been talk of a monument in my area, and I'm wondering, the protected lands are protected. I encourage each one of us to get a very clear, and Representative McLean was going there in his questioning, and I didn't hear the answer. What are we protecting that is not protected and why do we want it protected, and protected from what? I've not seen a spot on the map that is either not protected or is not governed by an agency with protections. What are we protecting against? I think this is really about, it's about many questions, but I think one very salient point is, what is this effort about? Is it about protection? Then we need to have a really serious conversation about that. Or is this about issues, or is this an issue about control and who controls whom? Because we all know if you control the purse strings, you can control the land, you control the water, you have the control. I really think that that's what this issue is about, and I'd hope as all of you are very versed in this issue as you go forward and hear the testimony, that you listen maybe with those lens. It's control. And for what purpose? And maybe it's a good purpose and maybe it's not. But I think that that's a great filter to look at this issue through. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Okay, so for the folks, I've got it listed as starting with Elias. You have to tell me that name. Steve Boren and Brian Wolf as our first group. There'll be two panels. Again, 30 minutes. A little time for Q&A, and then we can get folks back up from the other side for questions after that. We have a little time if we need it. Okay. Please, welcome. Egeren. Oh, my Lord. Egeren.
Egeren.
I'm going to remember that.
Fairly phonetic, but a little intimidating to look at.
It's that I that's throwing me off.
Yeah.
Egeren. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for giving us some audience this morning. My name is Elias Egeren. I'm a cattle rancher from Arock, Oregon. I actually live 30 miles from Idaho and 70 miles from Nevada. I drove nearly 400 miles yesterday to be in front of you today. A little bit of background. My great-grandfather came from the Basque Country in Spain when he was 12 years old, came and joined his uncle on the Waihi River, and came here to herd sheep. They were in sheep production, and ultimately they bought the ranch that my family still lives on today. My wife and I work with my folks, and we raise cattle now. We run about 500 head of commercial cattle, and we rely heavily on public grazing permits in order to have our operation be viable. And my point being there is that he came from the Basque Country, and he is quoted in a publication from the High Desert Museum as having said, "If I'd had enough bread to eat, I never would have left the Basque Country." And he was able to come here and make a living, and we, generations afterwards, are still making a living by grazing animals responsibly, by being good stewards for the land. And we're taking care of it the best of our ability and working in conjunction with state and federal management agencies to do so. And to that end, I'm a graduate from Oregon State University with a degree in animal science, and trying to do a better job with the animals in order to produce the highest quality protein in the world for our country, for our quality of life, for anybody who's in the marketplace to buy that, and have the opportunity to pass that opportunity along to my children. I'm also representative of the Owyhee Basin Stewardship Coalition. We are a nonprofit coalition who came to be in February of this year, and mainly in response to this monument proposition. Our mission statement is to advocate for all natural resource-based industries within Malheur County, and we are represented by, we have the president of the local Oregon Hunters Association is on our board of directors, also represented by local businessmen, cattle ranchers, city and county government officials, and we speak widely against this monument designation. We have retained a professional public affairs organization to help us in doing so, and while that may seem fairly commonplace for you folks and the lives you live, it's a first for those of us in our area. We deem that this issue is so important that we need to reach out and raise the money, and the amount of money that we have raised in a short time is unprecedented for any cause in our region. As far as our efforts go, we have an online petition on our website, Our Land, Our Voice, and as of this morning, we have exceeded 4,700 signatures on that petition, and that's just been in the last 60 days, urging Governor Brown and U.S. Senators Wyden and Merkley to urge the White House to not designate this area as a national monument under the Antiquities Act. And our major concern as a group, as a coalition, is access within this area. They can tell us all day long, they meaning the proponents of the monument, that cattle grazing will continue on, your recreation will continue on, but they never say at what level. Are we going to be, you know, back to horseback and covered wagons going out with our Dutch ovens across the desert to herd our cattle? How are we going to be able to maintain our water resources out there? We have hundreds, if not thousands, of miles of pipelines out there that the BLM put in initially and were turned over to us as the private individuals to maintain. And it's black poly pipe that's an inch to 2 inches in diameter, buried 2 feet under the ground, and miles of it, and about 40, 50 years old. It's breaking, and we're having to go out there. We don't know how we're going to be able to maintain these resources under potential monument designation. And not only do our cattle benefit from this, but the wildlife are as well. All the avian species, coyotes, the badgers, the antelope, the mule deer, everything that grazes out there are using these resources. What's going to happen if we go away? That's the big question for us. Noxious weeds and invasive species are a large concern. There is a lot of collaboration going on between private individuals and county and state entities in order to take care of noxious weeds. What's going to happen there? We don't know. From history, our access has been denied in these areas, certainly been restricted in the use of certain chemicals and mechanical means of eliminating juniper have been taken away. So these are a large part of our concerns. Also, fire suppression. In Jordan Valley, we have a Rural Fire Protection Association. That is a product of state statute in Oregon, and it gives us the ability to protect our private interest in the public domain. So we take our own vehicles, our own four-wheelers, our own pickups, our own water trucks to go out and fight fire hand-in-hand with the BLM. And a lot of times, we're the first ones on the fire because we live right there where the fires are happening. In fact, with the soda fire last year, several members in this room were part of the group that put the northwest end of that fire out, because we are so coalesced and prepared to do so. And if we don't have an opportunity to be involved in the public lands, as we fear we may not under this type of designation, then there's no reason for us to exist to aid in that fire suppression. And as far as the CCAAs that Representative Bentz discussed, we are the private landowners that are voluntarily saying here, we want our private land to be involved with these management strategies in order to improve the ecology of the land. So that these ecosystems, these specific species have an opportunity to come back, that they aren't driven to extinction, and we are willing to do so. And that speaks to our desire to manage this land in the best way possible. And it's really, in our opinion, rash and even somewhat of a belligerent move to force a monument declaration in this area. I would like to sum up with, while there's a lot of discussion about polling that goes on, the actual ballot measure that took place on March 8th in Malheur County, 90% of the registered 90% of those voting voted no against a monument designation in this area. That is with a 54% turnout. And that was a single ballot issue, by the way. That wasn't tied to a primary, wasn't tied to another issue. It was just simply yes or no. Do you support a monument designation in this area? And 90% of folks said no. We in Malheur County have spoken very firmly. We are very secure and certain in our voice and in our message, and we hope that you folks on this committee will be willing to join with us and speak to our governor, our U.S. senators, potentially the White House, and say this is bad for Oregon, this is bad for the land, it's bad for the people who live there. Thank you for your time.
Representative in the committee, I'm Steve Boren. I'm from Idaho, just over the border in Owyhee County, and I don't have any financial stake in this situation. I recreate in this area, and I have for the past 30 years. I hike there with my family and friends. I raft there with my family and friends and have done so for a long time. I spend quite a bit of my free time over there in that area. I feel like I know quite a bit about it. I came prepared to tell you about how wonderful it is, but everybody has told you how wonderful it is. So I'm going to throw those notes away and tell you a couple stories, since you love stories. First story comes from national news. Just recently, you probably all heard this. A gentleman was in Yellowstone National Park, saw a buffalo calf, thought it looked cold. Thought, oh, I've got to help. I've got to protect this from being cold. So he put it in the back seat of his car. Thought he was saving that thing. Thought he was doing the right thing. I have no doubt that that gentleman had no ill will towards that buffalo calf. Thought it was beautiful. Thought it was wonderful. Wanted to protect it. What ended up happening? They had to euthanize it because they couldn't ever get it paired back up with his mother after he took that away to protect it. So his protection killed it. Now, did he want to kill it? No, of course not. So how does that, that ties directly into what we're talking about today. Everybody in this room loves this area. Everybody in this room thinks it needs to be cared for, thinks it needs to be protected from bad things, whatever those may be. Future mining development, future wind development, all those things. Great. We all want to protect it. We want to take care of this area. But how do we do it? We don't do it by relying on outside influence like the guy from, he wasn't even from the U.S. He was a tourist. He's not the guy who should be tasked with protecting that buffalo calf. He decided he was and killed it. The people who worked on that park, who understood how things work, who understands that that buffalo calf may in fact look cold, but he's not. He's designed by nature to not be cold. He's got a nice coat on him. What he needs is his mother. And that's what that gentleman didn't understand. I suggest to you that President Obama and those who are urging him to give us this mandated monument don't understand what this country needs, what the Hawaii country needs. I suggest to you that they don't truly understand what's going on the ground. They think this needs to be protected. It's wonderful. It is. But what's wrong with the status quo? Representative McLean, you suggested, what is wrong with the status quo? Let's talk about that for a second. Mr. Fente had used some wonderful superlatives to describe the Hawaii country. Mr. Sterling suggested on his raft trip that all the people were referring to the country in these wonderful superlatives. I think I've heard it described, this area described as beautiful, spectacular, iconic. This is in this room today. Wonderful. All these are things people have used to describe this area as. And I think everyone on both sides of this room would use those terms to describe this area. How did it get that way? It got that way because of the status quo. That's how it got that way. The status quo gave us a beautiful, spectacular, iconic, wonderful landscape, a wonderful functioning ecosystem. I suggest to you, this is not broken. So let's encourage outside influences to not try to fix what's not broken. This works. Mr. Sterling had suggested the tremendous economic impact from tourism and how when they go rafting there, they spend all this money, which is true. They spend some money there, but I hope you noticed at the beginning of his speech, he also indicated that he hadn't been there for 4 or 5 years because of river flows. Well, you can't maintain an economy on some money now and some money in 4 years and maybe some money in 3 years after that. Who knows? You maintain an economy on things that are there every day, functioning industries, functioning businesses that don't come and go willy-nilly at the whim of the weather, which is what the tourism industry does. That's how that works. That's not how you build an economy. Don't mess with the economy that works. Don't mess with an ecosystem that works. I wish I could take all you guys down there on a tour. I wish I could take you down the river. I've done almost every river in the western United States. I've been river rafting since I was 3 years old. There's no place more spectacular than the Hawaii. You can go down the Grand Canyon. I have. It's amazing. I would suggest to you that if you put in at Rome and go down to Birch Creek, you'll see canyon just as spectacular as you'll see in the Grand Canyon. And I believe that. I've seen them both many times. They're just as spectacular. It's wonderful country. I agree with everybody here. Let's
go about this the right way. It needs to be local. It needs to be collaborative. It needs to be the people of Oregon. It does not. Why in the world would you have the President of the United States tell you how to protect something in your backyard? Whether you like the President of the United States or not, you got to understand that he's never been there. He doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to this area. Everybody in this room does. Let's get them together. Let's figure out solutions that take care of this country as it's been taken care of for so many decades so far. All of these gentlemen from ONDA and from the proponents had suggested how amazing this country is. I agree with them wholeheartedly. But I happen to understand that the status quo form of management is what has made it that way. I happen to understand that if you truly love that buffalo calf, you're not going to let somebody from outside stick it in the back seat of their car and end up in death. Let's take care of this the right way. Let's use common sense and be intelligent about how we approach it. Please. Thank you for your time.
George, we're going to see if you can help the other next three get their full 15 minutes by going a little short.
I'm really concerned with that.
I just know Barry. I'm going to try and cut him down. But I might keep him to five, maybe not six.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thanks for allowing us to be here. My name is Brian Wolf. I am the elected sheriff of Malheur County. I've been a resident of Malheur County for 54 years, been in law enforcement for 25 years, and with the Malheur County Sheriff's Office since 1997. I'm here on behalf of the citizens.
You know what? You can go longer. I'm going to cut the realtor guy off. No offense, realtor guy. I forgot you're the sheriff. I was thinking you're the realtor guy for a second. I read all about you in the paper. You go as long as you want. Sorry, realtor. He's probably one of my constituents, too. I can vote for me in the fall. Sorry, sheriff.
Thank you, Chair.
You go for a while.
I will try to keep a time in mind. I'm here on behalf of the citizens who elected me, behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, which has also joined the coalition to oppose the National Monument designation in the Owyhee Canyon lands. I have grave concerns over the campaign calling on President Obama to declare 2.5 million acres of the Owyhee Canyon lands a national monument. My concern is shared with the Malheur County residents who voted 90% to oppose the monument earlier this year. I have spoken to sheriffs in Kane and Garfield counties in Utah, where the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument is located, and they've described to me firsthand the unintended consequences of the National Monument designation and the ability of local law enforcement to conduct search and rescue and the impact to reduce grazing on wildfires and the local economy. Every year, hunters and fishermen, hikers, rock hounds, wildlife photographers, stargazers visit these public lands to enjoy the beauty of the desert and the canyon lands and to see the wildflowers in the spring. If a monument is declared, many roads they use would most likely be closed, greatly prohibiting their use and enjoyment. And for those who do still venture into the desert and the wildlands, our ability to conduct search and rescue operations when people are lost or hurt will be severely hampered and without the use of the maintained or even unmaintained access roads. National Monument Declaration means less grazing on lands. Less grazing means heavier fuel loads for wildfires, less tax money for local government agencies and groups to help fight those fires. A dangerous combination for both visitors and, even more importantly, the land itself. I think we all want healthy land, and we also want a healthy economy. A monument declaration that reduces grazing will have a devastating effect on our local small businesses. Livestock is a driver of our local economy, and crippling the driver would have widespread negative effects. The unintended consequences are undisputed by communities where monument declarations have been made, which is why, just this last Thursday, Utah Governor Gary Herbert stood with his state tribal leaders and with the residents of the state of Utah to send a clear message to President Obama that Utah does not want another monument. And while these are good reasons to oppose the monument, the most important reason is that the very heart of our community is at stake. As has already been mentioned by Chair Clem, over 41 days earlier this year in neighboring Harney County at the Mauhere Wildlife Refuge, our community was torn apart. A group of outsiders came in with their own agenda. Their actions ignited anger and hurt. It exposed deep-seated fears, frustration, and mistrust of the government that had grown slowly over time. I attended town hall meetings in both Harney and Mauhere counties, where emotions were high, where opinions were voiced, and divides opened up that pitted neighbors against neighbor. And I know of family members who no longer talk to one another, good friends who no longer speak. At one of these meetings, nearly 500 people filled a gymnasium at the Vail High School. These are good, hardworking people, and they are afraid. I gave my personal cell phone number out at that meeting, and to this day it is not uncommon for me to get a call in the middle of the night or to receive a visit at my home unannounced. We are still working through what happened. It is really hard for me to describe, but I can tell you that there was tension in the communities that was widespread, and I've never felt tension like this before. Maybe if you're a footwear company in Portland or an activist in Bend, this sounds quite trivial. Maybe you shrug it off, but for an entire region of this state, it has been all too real and all too painful. Calling on President Obama to declare a 2.5 million acre monument in eastern Oregon is almost unconscionable. After what this community has been through, it will be the salt in the wounds of a region that is trying to heal. It will ignite the same frustration, hurt, and anger, and uncertainly pain and fear that we experienced just a few months ago and continue to experience. During these 41 days, we spent a lot of time and energy attempting to calm people down. I don't mean to be an alarmist. That's not my intent. But if a monument is declared in Mauhere County, I am concerned about public safety. I am concerned about the people from outside the area who will come to our county with their own agendas. We will not be successful in dealing with these folks. I fear they will not be reasonable. What we need now are not actions that divide or pit one group against another. That hurt local families and communities that have cared for our land for generations and generations. What we need now is healing. That's why I ask you, our state elected officials, to stand with us in sending a clear message to President Obama that the time and place for the nation's next national monument is not Mauhere County, and certainly not now. As a sheriff of Mauhere County, my job is to restore and maintain peace. That is what we need now, more than ever, is peace. And we need your help. So today, we ask that you stand with us, and we give thanks for your service. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so just in case we don't get these gentlemen back up, if there's a question or two, we have three more from the same overall side to go, but rather than lose time in transit, anything specifically for these three at this second? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, I was very glad to have someone who's familiar with the canyon area personally. We had earlier testimony that Idaho protected its side of this area in 2009. as someone from Idaho who comes to this area and the Oregon side as well, can you tell me what differences you see in this area between what Idaho protected in 2009 and what Oregon's level of protection is today?
So, yeah, I can, and thanks for asking that. And that's a great question. The country's pretty similar, and what we're doing in that country is pretty similar in Idaho. The Waihi starts in Idaho and Nevada, comes into Oregon, and I think it has its longest run in Oregon, but it's pretty long through Idaho and Nevada too. And that the Waihi deal we did is interesting. And sure, there's a lot of contention about that one also, but the interesting difference in what happened there is that was the result of years of collaboration between the people on the ground working in that country and our representatives in Washington, our state representatives and our representatives in Washington. And you're looking at the result of years of collaboration, and that's why it's working. It's not perfect, and everybody I know has things they don't like about it, but let's be honest, that's life, right? I mean, where do you find perfection and everything goes your way? Nothing ever happens that way. But you got a lot of people who, with a stake in that game, came together, met and argued and hashed things out, compromised. We came up with a collaborative solution, and our representatives in Washington took that through and got it done. So that's uniquely different than what's trying to be done here. This is like the backdoor version to try to get a similar result, but you end up with a bad result because you don't go through the process. You guys understand process. You guys are all lawmakers. That's how it works. It's process. And that's what happened in Idaho. That's what you need to do here from my point of view, because I've seen it done, or I participated in it there. So I've seen it done. If you don't participate in that here, you're shooting yourself in the foot, because you're going to end up with a nightmare that all you're going to spend the rest of your time litigating. I mean, let's be honest, Onda supports themselves with litigation. So that's the real goal there. But anyway, the important thing is the Idaho deal came about from collaboration. That was not mandated by the executive branch of the government. That came from the elected people's representative portion of the government and the contribution of the people along the process of talking with them. So I think you're crazy not to at least follow that model if you want to try to protect some country.
That's exceedingly helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and I'm going to have the other three come back, our next three come up, and then if we have questions back to you, we'll figure out at the end how we're going to handle that. So my apologies to our nice realtor friend, George, Barry, and Jerome.
I think he lives in my district.
Oh.
Yeah, careful.
Yeah. If you're a post-constituent, I apologize that you have to have an Oregon duck as your legislator, Mr. Gravenhorst. I don't know how that happened, but...
Sad.
Yeah, it is sad, really. It is, really.
Except for football season.
Oh.
Ouch.
It's a fluke. It's a Coos Bay guy who's doing it. That's why.
Sure. We ready?
Welcome, yep.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Klimt. This thing working? There we go. Morning, Chair Klimt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jerome Rosen. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. OCA represents the interests of nearly 1,800 ranchers across the entire state of Oregon. Typically, that means analyzing and conveying potential economic effects of any particular policy initiative on Oregon beef producers. As many of you on the committee know, our committee is dominated by family-owned businesses. The way of life for ranchers cannot be divorced from the economic effects of any policy proposal. Ranchers across the state are dependent on the land they grow their cattle on. They care deeply about preserving the land so that future generations can also work the land, enjoy the land, and live off the land. The designation of millions of acres of federal land in Mahir County as a national monument not only risks economic vitality for some of our members, but the life they've known for generation and vision for their families in the future. I'm testifying today to give this committee our perspective on the battle over national monument designation in the Waihi Basin, an effort that local communities there overwhelmingly oppose. I'm also here to ask our counterparts at ONDA and the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and corporate interests at Keene Footwear
to carefully consider why their efforts are so frightening for the people who actually live, work, and play every day in the Owyhee Basin. You may have heard that this destination is not about grazing rights and that no existing grazing rights will be affected. Unfortunately, we have seen this process play out across the West in the past. Even if that's not the legal effect to start, it has been the practical effect over the long term in other places, costing families the ability to feed and raise cattle and make a living. In Escalante, New Mexico, a special interest group sought and attained national monument designation for the Grand Staircase. The same groups eventually bought grazing rights, specifically set out to end grazing altogether. Frankly, our members do not trust the proponents of the monument designation because we've seen their allies use the designation as a means to purchase grazing allotments, negotiate with BLM, and to attempt to stop grazing altogether. Even if existing rights are protected, we are certain that these efforts surely will affect grazing rights, ultimately limiting the economic opportunities for families in some of the poorest parts of our state and the country. It would be foolish to believe that many of these types of efforts aren't specifically tailored to try to ultimately keep cattle off our federal lands. That may not be the goal of every special interest group, but it is the end game for some of the many members and donors, many of whom do not understand ranching or the economic reality of those living in these rural areas. Despite a multitude of state and federal regulations and well-established practices for grazing and land management by the BLM, state agencies, conservation groups point to their own preferred practices, scientific findings, often alleging that the grazing on the land is damaging riparian areas, causing irreparable harm and threatening the land for years to come. These proposals are damaging and unfair to those ranchers committed to the preservation of the landscape they depend on and the health of the animals they raise. The ability to feed cattle on federal rangeland is not just about grazing rights and ranching success. For those who aren't familiar with small ranching communities, availability of grazed lands is a mechanism to succession planning, allowing young families to continue the family business and a future of young people trained exclusively in ranching to start and grow their own operation. Without the ability to obtain a new grazing allotment, a father with two or more children, all interested in continuing the family tradition, have to continue dividing their property, their grazing rights, and their income in order to provide for multiple generations and families. This is leading to real poverty, already ravaging areas, both ranching and in other industries. Ranching is not just a business, but a heritage and a culture. Please do not underestimate how difficult it is for many working families in rural places to envision a life in a different industry and in an unfamiliar geographical area, particularly in an urban area. Our population centers in Oregon are already tight on supply of working class jobs and affordable housing. While the goals of monument designation undoubtedly are well-intentioned, they fail to recognize the true human and economic impacts in areas like the Owyhee Basin. As economic opportunity in Oregon is depleting, we see higher demand for public services through the state and greater pressure on the already limited number of living wage careers. It is a mistake to presume that the next generation of ranchers in those communities can all simply choose a new career, finance their education, and move to a more densely populated area to raise their families. The needs of the local communities must be carefully balanced against the benefits of setting aside federal land. We are here today not just to educate you about this issue and the practical effect of grazing rights, but we ask the proponents of the monument to carefully consider what this means for the people in the Owyhee Basin. Unfortunately, few of our members trust the long-term motives of groups pushing for monument designation or other protections. We've seen where parallel efforts ultimately lead to monument designation without a congressional vote. Regardless of the will of the affected community and ultimately cost ranchers the ability to raise cattle, today OCA asks the Oregon legislature for any support it can provide for the people of the Owyhee Basin. We ask ONDA, OLCV, Keene, and others to trust that our members can deeply care about conserving the land they live, love, and depend on to raise their families. Many of them hope their families will continue to care for the land for generations to come. We are asking you to consider to try to understand our way of life so that you can understand and believe our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clem. My name is Barry Bashu. I'm proud to be the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I've submitted online a relatively lengthy letter of comments, and uncharacteristically, I'm going to go off script here. This whole conversation has frankly fascinated me. I've watched as people have come up. I really appreciate the presentation by Representative Vance and the inclusion of all the layers of protection that are already there. One of the things that keeps coming to mind is the fact that, and I agree with the initial panel, that this is a wonderful area. It's a beautiful area. People recognize that. The Pew Research talks about it from, I believe, 7 different points of view about all the wonderful things that are happening there. I say to you that the reason that is because the people that live there, the ranchers, the farmers, the local communities, and the business that have taken 150 years in making it what it is. It's not because of government. It's not because of protection. The record is full of government-owned properties across the state of Oregon, across the United States, that are poorly managed, mismanaged. There's always funds to buy property. There's always funds to take property. There's always funds to extort property from private landowners. There's never funds to manage them. I cannot understand why this process would be any different. Senator Ferrioli made some excellent points, but I want to concentrate on what Representative Springer said. She talked about this being about control. And I think if you've listened to the entire conversation here, that is exactly what this is about. We heard a lot of conversation from the first panel, about collaboration and sitting down in a room and developing solutions. ONDA has 50 lawsuits since the 1990s targeting public lands grazing. 22 of them have been since 2005, and 2 of them are still in the court. That litigious record precludes, in my opinion, the assumption that ONDA has any real interest in local communities, local economies, the ranching community, the people that have made Owyhee what it is. I think it's disingenuous. You got another group that talks about wanting to sell tents and shoes and sporting goods. Awesome. I buy those things. But at what expense? Are we going to support their economy? Are we going to support their business model at the expense of ranchers like Elias, who are 4 generations into developing a livelihood for not only him, but a core of the economy in the state and that region? I'm sorry. I just find that absolutely incredulous that people would put the value of their business selling products at the expense of the people who have made the property what it is today. I'm frankly floundering here to understand why people would not want to engage in a congressional discussion, would not want to engage in an opportunity to look at what this is, how it got there, and give the people that got it there the credit that they so richly deserve. But I don't hear that. I hear utilizing of the Antiquities Act with a sign of a pen from the President of the United States to put this area under some kind of control that it hasn't been shown to necessarily need. The words, and I'm going to talk about one of the other panelists, the words of iconic, the words of awesome, all came to fore. And they came to the fore because of exactly the people that are here representing them today. I urge you strongly to talk to the governor. You folks have an opportunity and an obligation to the citizens of Oregon to be spokespeople for what the right process is to make these kind of things happen, if, in your opinion, they need to happen at all. It's not about mandates. It's not about the presidential decrees. It's not about the Antiquities Act. It's, in fact, about the people that are on the ground. It's the people that you represent, the people that you have an opportunity to help engage in a collaborative process, not collaboration at the point of litigation. I see no value in that whatsoever. It's like putting a gun to somebody's head and saying, you agree with me, don't you? I hope you do that. I hope you talk to Senators Wyden and Senators Merkley. Certainly Congressman Walden understands that Congressman Schrader does. I haven't spoken to the other folks, but you have an opportunity to have those discussions with these people to put this thing to a stop and rectify the damage that's already been done by these proposals and the anger and the angst that has arisen because of that. So I thank you for your time, and I apologize if I was too long.
Okay, George. I'm not going to hold you to negative 2 minutes and 38 seconds, which I'm supposed to here, but keep it brief, and then I'm going to get to some questions for you, gentlemen.
In the context of time, I'll keep it very brief. My name is George Grabenhorst. I am the president-elect of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm going to go off script, too, and just give you a little bit of where we're coming from on this issue. Those people that live in that area and the economy of that corner of the state, by designation of a national monument, will be for irreparably hurt with that designation. It is going to affect property values. Most of those ranches that are there now will become what we call hobby ranches with the loss of the grazing area, and believe me, they will lose their grazing at one time or another. So we are very much opposed to this designation of a national monument and would rather see this be something that is done on a local basis with local consensus and local discussion. Thank you.
Boy, you are good. Thank you. Okay, so let's have now you're back under schedule almost. Let's have a couple questions, and actually I want to ask the very first panel to come back because I have some questions for them as well, if any. For this panel. Okay, good. You wowed us. No. Sorry, you had your negative 2 minutes and a half. So, Brent, can you come back up with maybe Tim and Bob? Before I hog the mic, is there anybody else who would like to ask a question of this panel?
Sure.
I could have guessed that.
I try to be fair, and then I end up killing my own time here, but please.
Mr. Reese? Where's he at? Oh, you, maybe it's Mr. Sterling. That I went to, I had a question for, but.
I'm sorry, I didn't know we'd get a fourth chair. Go ahead, yeah.
You painted a picture in your presentation that Oregon is neglectful in its efforts to protect public lands, and yet, as you cited Idaho as being more protection, Representative Benz testified that. Outside of the Hawaii designation is an effort by some members of the community, his family, to establish a gold mine, but that they haven't been able to do that, which would be an economic boost due to the land use system. Is it fair to say that in calculating the treatment of protection in that Oregon's centralized land use planning system should be considered when we evaluate policy as to the economic stability of rural communities?
Well, first, I think you put some words in my mouth. I didn't say Oregon's been neglectful. I stated that the statistics show, and you can look it up, that
I beg to differ. I actually think if you look over your testimony, you'll see that you painted a picture, and maybe you didn't use the word neglectful, but you very clearly implied that we are being
a
neglectful.
Do we want to have a meaningful conversation?
Let's go, please answer.
Okay. This isn't a meaningful conversation?
Let's let him get you asked. Let's let him get his answer.
Sure.
Okay. My point is, and the point I was trying to make, is that studies throughout the West demonstrate the more protected public lands that those states have, the communities near those lands have higher economic growth. That's the only point I was trying to make. Oregon is well behind our neighboring states in the percentage of protected public lands that we have.
Okay, then my follow-up would be, it's quite shocking to me that the premise of your advocacy is implying that Oregon's centralized land use planning system has somehow failed to protect the land in Oregon with regards to economic abuses, because ultimately, if what you're saying is that people have, in Idaho, for an example, because of their protection, they have better economy on the other side of the river, I think Representative Bentz would find that quite surprising.
Well, we're talking about two different types of lands. So when I was referring specifically to lands managed by the federal government. Oregon's land use planning manages the uses on private land.
I understand.
Two very different things.
I understand the distinction. And I think of course, your statement begs the question to say that you don't isolate the federal management from what is going on all over the region, which involves, at least in Oregon, intense land use system, so that to simply imply that federal land protection somehow is an economic driver without considering...
Many studies demonstrate that more protected federal lands help economic development. I'm just stating, I can send you all those studies if you'd like to see them.
Please do.
I'll do that.
Do you understand my point?
Well, honestly, I don't.
I think his point, which, to be fair, I'm a proponent.
I'd be happy
to
make my point, Mr. Chair.
He's not. The point is, we do have. So this proposal is about public lands.
Correct.
And there are also lots of things that we do here in this committee, even to regulate private lands. So aggregately, between the public and private lands, there are a variety of uses that are off limits through our state laws and also federal laws. And so if you look at the aggregate whole, federal ownership plus the land use system do largely preserve areas in Oregon for farming and or recreation already. There's just nothing else really allowed under our exclusive farm use rules. A lot of us like it that way, but it's challenging when people can't make a living to defend that system over and over
right.
and over and over again.
Well, I think the point has been made throughout this panel that we're not talking about any change in the grazing on these lands. We're talking about preserving these lands from extractive activities like energy development and unregulated off-road vehicle use. So from my perspective, and take it or leave it, is that you can maintain the current economy that you have on these lands and add a recreation, an outdoor recreation benefit that currently may not be reaching its potential.
So Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if any of the panel members here know, or maybe Representative Bentz does, but I'm interested in how much of the land that we're discussing for a potential Owyhee National Monument is currently in public ownership.
100%.
So, Mr. Chairman, follow up, please. One of the themes of this panel was that hunting and fishing is important to you individually, and I think by extension culturally for families, etc. I am at a loss as to understand, because the statement was that these lands are threatened. We're threatened with a loss of losing, quote, public access for hunting lands, end of quote. I'm unaware how you lose access to hunting and, by extension, fishing off of publicly owned lands.
I don't believe that you do under this proposal.
That was the testimony of your panel. Thank you very much.
Of my pen?
Of this panel. That was the testimony. Thank you. I appreciate the answer.
Representative Witt, I don't believe we testified what I'm saying is, this proposal would not eliminate public access to public lands, is what I'm trying to make clear. I think
the testimony, Mr. Chairman, the testimony was that absent the designation of a federal monument,
uh-huh.
that there was a risk of losing public lands access for hunting.
Sure. Thank you. I didn't understand your first point. You know, one, I would note that there's been a lot of talk about national monument in this, and I want to be clear, what we have proposed for years now is a national conservation area with wilderness. We do believe any form of protection should be on the table. We should figure out how this area receives the protection it deserves, and unlike some of the folks in the other, on the other panel, I don't believe status quo is an option. I think the layers of protections that Representative Bent spoke to, I would agree that a lot of those are processes that are in place, but there's only one form of permanent protection on that list, and that is the Wild and Scenic River Corridor that stretches from 1,000 feet on each side of the river. There are other forms of protection that have been put in place temporarily, such as a wilderness study area, the emphasis on study. That protection's been in place for 3 decades now, and I would suggest, okay, you ask, you know, maybe most of you are married, perhaps. You ask someone to marry you. You get engaged. And if 30 years come around and you haven't actually tied the knot, I think there'd be some skepticism that your intent to give those areas permanent protection or to actually marry the person you propose to is genuine. That's what we're facing here, is that there may be some interim protections in there, but we have not made a commitment to holding this landscape together. And absent that, the types of development that could result, oil and gas and mining, could happen in, you know, all those, quote, layers of protection. Those layers of protection, you know, that are in place on our public lands across most of the West. You look at the oil and gas fields in Wyoming, those layers of, quote, protection are there. It has not eliminated the absolute ravaging of that land by roads, oil and gas derricks, etc. So that is the point that I'm trying to make, that I think most of us, if you raised a show of hands and said, you know, if this area was crisscrossed with roads that would eliminate wildlife populations and, you know, would you end up hunting there? Would you go there? It's not a matter of that it would eliminate access. There'd be no reason to go out and hunt there as there is now.
Mr. Chairman,
I want to get Representative Gilling.
I'd like to clarify the record.
Sure.
In the absence of monument status, there is no threat that these lands, that the public will lose access to these lands for hunting and fishing. They are already under public ownership.
Yeah. Representative Gilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated the comparison. Not only this panel, but the other, with Oregon and Utah, for example, and the problems that were noted with Utah's monument. Someone mentioned Idaho's solution, and I'm grateful that they highlighted that it was a Republican senator, because that word is used very rarely in Oregon. However,
it's an endangered species over there.
I'm interested in what you thought of some testimony. And Tim, we have different buttons on. You live there. My question is about timing in Oregon. Timing with an exiting U.S. president. But more importantly, what the sheriff said about the sensitivity and the timing of a community hurting from issues you're well aware of. I'd be interested in your response to what you heard.
What I heard is, I'll just put it straight out there, is I think both sides really need to work together on this, just like the Awashi Idaho Initiative happened, is everybody needs to sit down in a room much like this and talk and figure out a plan. I mean, we've all talked stats and statistics and studies, and we know there's more and more pressure on that land regardless, whatever way we point. That's my hope, is that we start looking at much like the Oahe Idaho Initiative and use that as a model.
Yeah, that was one point I kind of wanted to make. The monument, certainly that's one thing, but this conservation area, would that end up being a bill, an act of Congress to do that?
That was the idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we had started this effort 10 years ago, the whole intent was to try to bring people together. Unfortunately, you know, I appreciated Representative Bence's acknowledgement of the Steens process and other folks' acknowledgement of the Oahu process of bringing people together. You can only bring people together if folks agree to come to the table. And I will acknowledge that's been a real difficulty. I understand the history, again, I noted it earlier, of the history of mistrust, et cetera. But, you know, I've seen it today where people selectively will pull, you know, a comment, and that seems to characterize the overall testimony that was made. I think, to Tim's point, short of getting people in the room, you know, we're not going to figure this out. It's not been for lack of wanting that to happen. I think you've seen a track record. You see this track record on the Steens and in the Oahu Initiative, where both of those areas were considered as national monuments as well. That's what ultimately drove people to the table to figure these things out. You know, it's unfortunate that we didn't start these conversations a decade ago or, you know, 8 years ago and work our way up to this point. But I think there's a track record of showing how we can do these things, that we can learn from, that make the process not as arduous or difficult as it might have been if we didn't have any other successes or failures to learn from around the West.
So do you think there is some opportunity? I know, you know, President Obama's got 6 months left. Is there an opportunity to try and get some people talking that could lead to a modified proposal or a act of Congress in lieu of a monument? I mean, I don't want to preclude outcomes, but getting people talking as a parallel track to whatever the president's going to do, he's going to do on monuments all over the country, I assume.
Yeah.
Or he may be watching right now, and he's just waiting for us to tell him what our outcome is, but maybe not.
You know, I don't want to be the only one speaking, but, you know, I think there's time. You know, we have, as you noted, 6 months. It may not seem like a lot, but it's time. And what I can guarantee you is folks are not going to come to consensus if they don't get in a room and start having these conversations. That's one thing I can guarantee, and that we'll continue to kind of feel like, okay, if no one's engaging, then is a monument or some other approach the only way these things get done, recognizing that Congress is not an easy place to do business, and that's why the president's pen stroke has seemed to, you know, be the tool, you know, the preferred tool at the moment. But, you know, I think I know I can speak for myself and say, you know, continue to be willing to have those conversations, you know, over the coming months, years, whatever, you know, it takes. But, yeah.
Chair Clem, if I could just add, I mean, there has been a discussion about mistrust between the conservation community and the folks that live on the land. But there's also, from the conservation community, there is a gross mistrust of Congress. I don't know where these poll numbers came from, that Congress is the appropriate avenue for this conversation to take place. But the folks in Congress had a monumental task in passing the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which gives incredible amounts of money to communities across the United States. We had to trade away the oil export ban in order to get a half-funded Land and Water Conservation Fund for the United States. We have yet to reauthorize the Magnuson-Stevens Act in federal waters, which has rebuilt stocks of fish. Conservation and Congress do not go hand in hand. And I think all of us in the room agree that the conversations, the best value that we have is the communities, the conservation community, and the landowners coming together to have that conversation. But, you know, where that ends up, probably in Congress, that's where our mistrust is.
Actually, I think that's probably universal to some extent.
No.
Most people would prefer we deal with things in Oregon, not Congress generally anyway.
Well, I you know, certainly that requires a retort.
Sure.
Because the ends don't justify the means. And I'm sure that those who are of a different party than President Obama are not necessarily confident he's going to be mindful of the communities that I represent. So it's hard for me not to take your comment as just simply partisan rhetoric. So because guess what? Congress is in one party. The president is the other, and you say, oh, Congress is bad, president good. Come on. I mean, that's no way to achieve consensus by simply dismissing your opponent's legitimacy. And there's certainly, you know, you label it a conservation community. You know, there's no I don't think there's consensus amongst the conservation community, just like saying that, you know, Protestants or Catholics all agree. I mean, there is wide diversity of opinion amongst those who consider themselves conservationists. So I just certainly don't agree that Congress is the problem. I mean, ultimately, these things are difficult, and this is why this meeting is intense, because there's no clear consensus on the path. But I'm not going to dismiss a constitutional branch of government and say that they somehow don't represent legitimate concerns of the people.
You remind me of something I do want to say. Well, again, we're 15 minutes over, but I feel like we're now basically back in balance here. So, you know, I think most of us value independence of thought, and we particularly admire when somebody takes a view that doesn't fit their normal paradigm. And that's why I wanted to commend Representative Bentz and the sheriff for how they dealt with a very challenging situation. To that end, I want to say, for all the other issues that people have mentioned about ONDA, I appreciated when ONDA sat here while other members of the environmental community said earlier that my bill, I'm biased, but my bill about building dams was horrible for the environment, and ONDA sat here and said, no, it's not. It's good to restore beaver dams, working with ranchers and figure out how to do it. And so that kind of thinking is what we need from everybody. Like, forget about whatever your affiliations were and process the problem and see what we can do to come up with solutions. And that's the best part about all this. We're all Oregonians in here. I don't see anybody here who, well, sorry, the one gentleman from out of state, but for the most part, we'll count you for a day to, as an Oregon resident, since you're close to the border. But for the most part, these are Oregonians talking to each other, which is, I think, the sentiment that people are trying to express, which is, even for those of us who voted for Obama twice, he isn't an Oregonian. Yeah, he's a resident of Illinois and or Washington, D.C., and so the idea that we could sit down and try and hash something out, I think, is attractive. Understanding the backdrop of, if it's just a delay tactic, he may act anyway. So let's get to talking, because we don't know what's going to happen. It's his decision, and maybe we can come up with some alternate plan to recommend instead in the meantime. So any final other words from committee members? You got one more shot.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for all your patience. Thank you for coming so far, folks. I'll now probably get back in the car and go all the way back.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well,
I'll get them back some other time.
Someday.
Some other time.
Someday.
Yeah. Well,
maybe I'll get them back.